Hola.
What's going on?
What is going on?
I'm a little late. I was
2 minutes.
my comics and I was like, hey, there's this Dark Horse comic I have, and it says it's got Roxy Delight. She's a burlesque dancer that I follow on Facebook. So I had to go to her site and see if she had anything about this. She's on the comic. It says featuring the return of Venomous Femme Fatale, Roxy Delight, a real-life burlesque superstar.
Then you got distracted by her website,
Oh yeah, her Facebook page.
her Facebook.
Yeah, well, I'm friends with her, so I was like, I knew that name. I just had to figure out which one she was.
Have to look at some pictures.
Yeah, I gotta see it for myself.
I thought, aren't I supposed to be doing something right now?
Yeah, and then, oops. Last track.
2 minutes late. That's 12
Yeah.
demerits.
I'm still sick, so I might lose my voice. I mean, it's a highly probable.
All right. I'll talk for you if that
Yeah.
happens.
I'll use the telepathy, and you'll
You can.
say what I want you to say.
I'll just do both parts of the script.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll have to work on my Latino accent since you have such a strong one.
Yeah.
But then Alan will get mad because I'm not the
You're
original.
white, yeah.
Yeah, I can't play your part.
Not in Valhalla Comics. You
No.
can't. I can only be vibe.
Right.
That's it. I'm kind of limited to the characters I can be. Or
Yeah.
the sky's the limit for you. It's not fair.
Yeah, I have a lot of options.
Yeah. I'm screwed in Valhalla Comics. Me and Daryl are in prison all the time. We're
Yeah.
good guys too. That's what sucks.
That's, I know, I just think if you were villains,
Yeah.
that'd be really bad for you. So this is our first episode post touching.
A touching.
We have now physically touched each other.
That's right.
And it'll never be the same again.
That's right.
It's been a few weeks. You've talked about Baltimore Comic Con on your other shows.
Yeah,
On
well,
Cheap
let's talk from your
Brunch.
perspective because you've heard me twice, so.
Yeah, but I had a great time. That was my first time being at a really large con like that. I've been to small hotel dealer shows, that kind of thing, without really a lot of professionals or celebrities there and stuff. And I went by myself and met up with you guys. Everybody, I was meeting everybody for the first time. I met probably 10 to 15 people that I'd known through social media for several years now. So it was a little overwhelming at first. I went from meeting you and Barb and Daryl to walking in and onto the con floor and seeing all these creators and artists sitting around that I'd been following for years. Everyone all of a sudden is live and in the flesh.
Yeah.
But I had a really good time. I was there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I'd say pretty quickly I felt comfortable though, especially around you guys. Everybody seemed like very similar to how they present themselves online.
Say they're
And
exactly the same thing. Why did I pay to come visit them?
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there was no money back guarantee, so
Yeah.
I was stuck there. But trying to think of what would specifically pertain to this show, the retro show. I think one of the highlights for me was the opportunity to meet Marv Wolfman, which I did really towards the end of the con on Sunday as things were quieting down. Got a chance to go over, and he was selling scripts with the donation, with the money going to charity. I think it was the Heroes Initiative. And so I picked up a script for Convergence, New Teen Titans number 2. I had him sign it and got to shake his hand. And as he's a creator who's written so many of my favorite characters and so many of my favorite comics. So it was neat to meet him. But there was a lot of creators. You had your handful of creators who are big names now, but you had a lot of creators there that were creators that we talk about on this show and people that were really big names in the 70s and 80s. You and I stopped early on by John Ostrander and Tim Truman's booth, and you had your Suicide Squad trade signed by him, and he was really nice. I've been talking about their creator-owned stuff recently on here with Grimjack and Ramona Freyden and Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Yeah, that was good. I got to meet him and get that poster that I got from him signed.
Yeah, you got a really cool print of the
And a
Uncle
cool
Sam.
picture with them too.
So that was neat. So that's one of the things that's kind of cool is that there's so many. In a lot of ways, comic books is they're still a young art form, compared to a lot of other media that's out there. And so, obviously, there are a lot of greats who we've lost, but there are even people who were golden age creators like Ramona Freyden that are still out at the cons and still people
I
that
think
you
she's
can
more
meet.
late, early silver.
Silver, yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Early Silver Age,
Like
but even so.
yeah, there are a few a golden age, but they're far, far between. There, I would say 6 years ago when I went to cons, I would see a lot more golden age artists. Like I see that one guy in Denver all the time that did Cap.
That you
But
do your that shows you how to punch.
yeah, that's he always he's amazing because he's just so vibrant, you know? He's so full of life. And I can only hope that when I get that age that I'm like that.
Seriously, yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking about how as you get older, people that are younger than you, each generation, you think, oh, when I was in my 20s, teenagers seemed really young. Now I'm in my 30s, and people in their 20s seem really young. And
Or the
I probably.
third for me it's like 30s.
I was gonna say now people like me seem really young to you, and
Yeah.
but so I was thinking, man, people in their 90s must just look at the whole human race as a bunch of toddlers.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had a great time. I mean, honestly, the highlight for me was spending time with you and Barb and Daryl and Alan and everybody that I met. There were people that I've been friends with online for a while that I got to finally meet in person, but there are also people who that I was just sort of familiar with their names, like Steven Andruski of Marvel Noise, that hadn't really interacted with much in person or online, but then got a chance to hang out with in person and made some new friends along the way. So it was definitely really worth it. Just for the, and one of the main reasons I enjoy comic book fandom is for the people, for the other fans and the friendships that I've made. So, if that's one of the things that you can really get out of an occasion like this, to
Yeah.
get to spend time with those people. And, I've mentioned everybody on Facebook that I had opportunity to spend time with. And so, yeah, I had a really great time.
Yeah, I always have a good time. I think that's why I go to those cons because I have big cons out west, but I don't have a hell of a lot of friends out west. Seems like all my friends are on the East Coast or Central time zone.
And it does kind of solidify those friendships.
Yeah.
You know, we joke that everybody kind of seems the same way as they are online. And but it is a nice way to sort of take those friendships that you formed online to another level, you know. But nowadays, just with the technology, the level that it is, you know, I've found that if you do get along with somebody and talk to them a lot online, that it's a pretty good chance that it's going to click pretty quickly when you're in person, you know,
Yeah.
and you're going to feel comfortable pretty quickly around each other and have a good time hanging out. Because after that initial moment of, whoa, that's Mike and Barb and Daryl standing right in front of me. It was pretty quickly to just feeling like a natural thing, you know?
Yeah, it's a good time.
So, but yeah, yesterday I actually went only for a couple hours to our local Buffalo Comic Con.
Yeah, I have another friend that mentioned you, but I don't think you ran into each other. His name is Rob.
Yeah, I had actually tried to meet up with Rob,
Yeah.
who I actually pretty much know through you, and I had become Facebook friends with him and noticed from some of his posts that he was in this area. So I'd actually got in touch with him and Sam Murdoch, who is friends with a lot of the Star Joe's guys, and
Yeah.
him and I had been friends on Facebook for quite a while, and I knew he lived around here too. So I contacted both of them to see if they were planning on going. And it did work out that I was able to meet up with Sam and his fiancée, Kayla. Rob messaged me after the fact. He didn't get my message till later on
Yeah.
because he was in a panel and didn't have cell phone reception. So we missed each other, unfortunately. But it was pretty neat. They had expanded this year to 2 days and expanded from having it at a hotel to having it at the convention center. And it's still a lot smaller. It's still kind of like a dealer con with maybe like the next step up from that now.
Yeah,
They
but
had a
didn't they
handful.
have a handful like an artist alley still?
Yeah, it was kind of. So it's kind of definitely a step up from just your regular dealer con. The big draw and the big thing that they had this year is that Jim Steranko was actually there. I only had a few hours, so I didn't end up meeting him because for one of the hours I was there, he was in a panel, and
He's
there
very
was
lively too, like
yeah, and there was a there
very
was a line,
talkative.
yeah. He had a line the whole time, and so I kind of had to make a choice between wait to meet him or spend my time doing other stuff.
Yeah.
But I did get to meet and talk with Bill Anderson, who is not a well-known name, but he's actually been an inker and artist in comics for a long time now. He's done work for both DC and Marvel. He inked a couple issues of Justice League of America during the Detroit era. He's done a bunch of different work. He did some work on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for Mirage, like the later issues. He probably his most well-known thing is he worked on that Elementals, that Bill Willingham
Oh yeah.
comic.
Kimiko.
Yeah. So I talked to him for a little while, and he had a couple previews of some Kickstarter projects he's got coming up that I signed up for his mailing list to get info on those. So he sounded pretty cool. And I got a cool print of one of the covers of one of the Ninja Turtle issues that he did and had that signed.
Yeah, I saw that you posted that.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. It was a cool
He did
conversation with
a
him.
little sketch on it there too, I saw.
Yeah, he did a little turtle head on there. So he was a really nice guy. It was neat to meet him. I didn't get to meet Ken Lashie, but he was there. He's current artist for DC, and has done a bunch of DC work in the past. He always had people in front of him. But I also got a cool flash drawing from, it's actually my wife's cousin. He was like her second cousin or something. They met at the library one time, and they have the same last name, and kind of discovered that they were related. But she mentioned him to me a long time ago, and I've been wanting to meet him. And he actually had a table there, and so I finally got to meet him and talk to him a little bit. And he had some cool prints. His style is kind of, it almost kind of reminds me a little bit of like a Ren and Stimpy. So it's like a cartoony style. He had this neat flash print that's Flash is running super fast, and it's making his mouth kind of fly behind him. So I posted a picture of that too. But yeah, all in all, I mean, it was pretty neat. I maybe could have used another hour or so, and then felt fully satisfied. Definitely didn't need 2 days. But it gives people a longer period of time to try to make it over there. There was a lot of kids there, which is just good to see. A lot of cosplay. That's pretty big. Just kind of a smaller scale than Baltimore.
Yeah. And you got a few back issues from Action Comics.
Yeah, I towards the end there before I left, I decided to dig into a couple. This one dealer had, it was either $1 an issue or 10 for 5. So I looked in there, and I found that they were actually in order, which is always appealing when you don't have a lot of time. And I was missing 3 issues from that run of Action Comics when it went weekly. And it turned out they had all 3 of the ones that I needed. So I grabbed those and then just found a bunch of other single issues. I actually picked out 5 and handed them to her. And she said, you know, if you have 5, it's 10 for 5. So you could just get 5 more for the same price. Oh yeah, I probably should do that. So, one of the other ones that I didn't post a picture of, I've been reading a lot of DC books from the 80s, and I kept seeing ads for Slash Marad, which is a mini series by Doug Munch and Paul Galassi. It's kind of neat to find out about a series that way, where you just see the house ads in old comics that you're reading. And so the house ads are still working several decades later to promote stuff. So I happened to come across issue number 1 in there, so I grabbed that so I could try it out, see if I, and then if I like it, pick up the other ones, because I don't think it's ever been reprinted.
So I think I have one of those issues, but I don't have any of them documented in my database. But I could have sworn I have one of them. 'Cause I'm looking at the covers now. It
Yeah, I
looks
didn't
pretty
read it.
like Road Warrior-ish.
Yeah, the ads looked really cool, and
The
that's what drew my
cover art
interest.
is awesome, especially like the second one. I really like it.
Okay. So I'll
Paul
probably read number one for next
Galassi is
time.
pretty awesome though too.
Yeah, and I tend to like Doug Munch's writing, so it's a promising creative team. So I think I'll probably save it. I'll probably read it for next episode. It'll be a good thing to talk about.
It definitely looks like something Road Warrior based, though. They have all
Yeah.
these, like, it looks like a dystopian future with all these crazy vehicles that are morphed.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks pretty cool, so
Yeah,
check
I've
it out.
definitely never read it, but I thought I owned one. It might be in the boxes that I haven't cataloged. I don't know. I gotta do that at some point to avoid getting dupes like that, you know?
Yeah.
I picked up a lot of comics at Baltimore. I think I picked up like 40 of them.
Yeah, you did
And it
some
was a
shopping.
lot of Black Hawk 12-cent issues where the Black Hawks actually had superpowers, which I've never read them before. And then I picked up a ton of Batman and detective that were like 80s that I needed to fill. It actually got really close to filling all the issues since 1973 on Batman and Detective because of that. And I got a few odds and ends like Blitzkrieg and Metal Man and Blitzkrieg. I think I covered an issue on this episode, or I covered it on something. But it's such a weird little mini series because it was destined for failure as soon as issue one came out. It's historically a mess because they tried to how could I say it? Make the humanitize the Nazis, like say that they were human too. So you were seeing the stories through their eyes, and it was very unusual. But yeah, I picked up a lot of stuff, and then I got commissions. I got a Wonder Woman from Ramona Freyden, and I also got a Super Friends that she drew. She did the cover and she did the interiors, and I had her sign it. So I have a signed Super Friends from her.
That's right.
And then I got that Garcia Lopez Wonder Woman versus Superman print and had that signed. And then I had a Black Hawk, a villainess that Andrew Peepoy drew for me from like it must have been the early 80s where that character really started popping up a lot. Her name was Domino. And it's not the Marvel Domino, but it's, that's this character's name. And then I
Yeah,
got another
I helped you
retro.
stock him.
Yeah, you
I
did.
spent a, I went to his booth a lot with you.
Yeah, it was rough, wasn't it?
It was tough to find him. Although we did end up having, I don't know if you talked about this on any of the other shows yet, but we did end up having a cool conversation with his neighbor.
Yes, that and that has like a retro vibe to it. Because
Yeah.
he would take a lot of like characters and then put them in on covers, like Leave It to Binky and other, like Legionnaires would show up on there, and like Star Trek would show up on, old covers, and he would like mimic the style.
Yeah. So it's John Watson was the
Yeah.
name of the guy, and this was his first time at a an American convention. He's British, but he had these really cool prints where he would take an original cover, and a lot of them were pretty DC focused.
I don't remember any Marvel focuses. I
Yeah,
think they
I
were
say
all
that it might
DC.
be all DC, but
I know he had some drawings of Marvel characters, but I don't remember him mocking up any Marvel comics.
I'm looking at the book. He had a little book called Covers There Never Were that we both got. And I'm flipping through it. There is one here that's Fantastic Four, but it's mostly DC.
Yeah.
So, for example, he'd take the cover of New Teen Titans number one and he redid it to the Legion of Superheroes instead of the Titans. And he has a real good ability to mimic styles, which adds to it. But he and the guy, his friend that were at the booth with them, they were definitely like old school DC fans, so we had fun talking to him. And John Watson, his own individual style, he's got kind of a painterly style, and I didn't realize it when we first walked up to the booth, but he did a lot of those covers of Hawkman when Geoff Johns was writing it,
Yeah.
which are really nice covers. So yeah, that was a cool conversation, John Watson.
Yeah. I didn't realize he gave us his contact information on the back of this book, too. It's interesting.
So yeah, that was neat.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
But yeah, you got that from Andrew Peeble, yes, and then you got the looker
Yeah,
from
the looker from
Shannon Gallant,
Shannon Gallant, yeah.
which is cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, got a lot of stuff. I would have liked to have gotten more, but because I'm on a plane, I try to limit it so I'm under 50 pounds in the luggage. But
Yeah,
if it was a local con, I'm sure I would take my Durango and fill it up. But I also want to do a quick retro shout out for what I did this week. I want to mention it here. But
sure.
every now and then I go to this comic shop weekly called Ed's Cards and Comics, and every now and then he comes across some really unique collections. And this week he had gotten a storage unit from the guy. He knows the guy who owns the storage unit, and somebody defaulted on their unit for over a year, which means he can take everything he wants and it's his. And he had like 25 short boxes, maybe more, maybe it was like 50. It was like a lot. I only went through 20 of them, but I actually took off like 2 hours from work so I could help him go through the boxes and tell him what I thought was valuable. So I actually did that, and I found a ton of shit for myself. And the one thing that I got out of it was, at least the big books, is I got Showcase number 30, which is the second appearance or Silver Age Aquaman. So he did appear in an Adventure Comics prior to that, his origin story, and then he showed up in Showcase and it kind of continued his origin story. And I have that issue, and then I have 33, which is like his fourth appearance, and then I got Aquaman number 1 and 2, and then another slew of Aquaman, and they're really nice shape. The only one that was beat up was 33 for the most part, because the cover was sort of detached. But I got like huge discounts on it, so like if you saw something in the price guide for a couple hundred, I would get it for four, you know, like 40 or 20, or depending on what was going on. But I got Flash of Two Worlds, man. And that seems like a huge book to have,
Oh
where it
yeah.
has Jay Garrick running on one side and Flash running on the other side, and then there's a character that's looking at the brick wall. They even mimicked it in the show just recently in this week's episode. So
That's
it's
kind of
like
one of the
weird
crazy
timing.
things.
It's
Yeah,
very
that's one of the
weird
crazy
timing.
things. It's like you got the book the week that they homaged it on the television show.
Yeah, and
That's
it's
crazy.
funny too, because I was like, Ed, do you know what you have here? And he was like, yeah, but look, I got Neil Adams, Green Lantern. I'm like, fuck that! Look what you got here. I
Yeah.
said, this is a much bigger book, in my opinion. But
I think it's one of the most important DC comics ever, really. It's
yeah, I
up
think.
there. I mean,
Yeah, so yeah, I was. And I have more books coming, but those are the big. I got a lot of old 12-cent Aquaman. So I kind of said, fuck this 1973 thing. If I get good opportunities on Silver Age or Golden Age DC, I'm just going to take them. But I'm so happy that I got it because it's really great shape. And the books that I saw were like fucking amazing. Like first appearance of this, first appearance of Wolverine. I saw two copies of that. Hulk 181. I mean, I saw a ton of shit that I would, if I had a unlimited bank account, I would have just bought everything, 'cause they're so key.
right.
But
Well, and that's the thing. It's not so much that you're just disregarding your goal with 1973, so much as an opportunity like that is a rare
yeah.
one that comes along. It's not like you were seeking out and going on mycomicshop.com and buying Flash of Two Worlds.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing where you have an opportunity like that is a rare opportunity that comes along, and you did make a decision, like you said. You didn't just buy everything. You went for things that were meaningful to you.
Yeah. I also got Green Lantern, the first appearance of Tattooed Man. So,
Nice.
yeah, I got a lot of great stuff, and I got more coming. I got a short box he's saving for me, and instead of splurging, like, because I helped him out and stuff, he's like, you know, you get these as you have the money, you know, and I'm gonna
Gotcha.
save them for you.
That's
So
cool.
that's awesome. He says, you've been a long time customer. I know you're good for it. You'll pay for all of it. So I'll be getting more. There's more to come, so.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that happens only because you have a relationship there that's established over time, you know?
And
You don't
it
just.
was so fun because like he had all the major collectors in his store like at the same time. And I'm talking about hardcore people that have like 50 th He's got the one speculator dude, so he was looking at the new stuff like Ultimate Spider-Man number one, which is like worth $100. He was grabbing all kinds of shit like that. And then he has like one guy that was looking for a full run of Flash and one for the Hulk. And like I got to talk to a lot of these guys. And these are like I don't know too many people that collect like me.
Right.
I mean, I know there's like John Mayo and Bob Breetal and there's a few others, but their collections are not like me and they don't buy all of previews like I do. So it's nice to see that there are other crazy motherfuckers like myself out there.
Yeah. You're not the only one.
Yeah, and we all use Comic Base. That's pretty cool. Every one of them uses them to, that to catalog their collection and drawer boxes, the right kind.
Yeah, I think if you have a collection of that size, you kind of have to go with Comic Base. I mean, my collection's pretty small, so I don't really need to, but I think when you have a comic collection that size,
Yeah.
Comic Base has the options and the features that you kind of need.
But as I had these books in my hand, I also did a lot of thinking too. It's like it's kind of sad at the same time, 'cause there's this collector, right, who lost all these books. And you know just from the quality of the books that he was like a collector like myself. You just know it. And then you start to wonder is why didn't he get his books? Is he dead? You start to think, and life starts to become finite, and you're like, I don't want that to be my collection. I do not want that to happen to my collection. So it's kind of sad at the same time.
Yeah, it does make you wonder because obviously it's not like he had a storage space that was full of junk. He defaulted on his payments, but obviously he had inside of his storage, he could have sold one or two of those books and paid his fee. So there has to be something other than just not
Yeah,
having
did he
money.
pass away? Did he have
Right.
to leave for something? I mean, it makes you wonder,
Yeah.
what happened? And he had other valuables in there, like Ed got a ton of toys, like the retro toys and stuff, and Playboys, which he sold immediately, which I found was interesting. I guess that's a hot thing now.
Well, yeah, they just announced that they're not gonna have naked ladies
Nudity
anymore.
anymore.
So that probably, I mean, there was already definitely a collector's market around older Playboys, but I
Yeah.
bet you that's gonna increase now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting topic to think about the stuff that you own and what it means to you and
What it meant to others,
what it
because
means to others, what you want done with it, if anything, if you care,
Yeah.
what's done with it when you, and do you want to make arrangements? I mean, I think some people are afraid to think about the topic, so then life catches them off guard, and they don't have any plans in place. And I could totally understand why people don't want to think about that. I can understand that. But if it's something that makes a difference to you, it's something that's worth taking the time to put some plans in place,
Every time I get
I
something
guess.
valuable, I show Barb. She looks at me with rolls her eyes, but I'm like, Barb, do you realize what this is? You own the Flash of Two Worlds, Barb. Barb, do you see that on the TV? That's the Flash of Two Worlds. I said, this is worth money. This is what I tell her is some of these books, they're not going to depreciate. Like there's going to be things that are cyclical, like what's hot now kind of thing. But usually when you go to silver, bronze, and gold, they don't depreciate. You don't see them go down.
No. No, you have your flavor of the month type things that are always going on when it comes to newer DC Marvel stuff that gets hot. I mean, so many copies of those are printed. And then you have your stuff in the 80s and 90s, especially the 90s. I mean, comics were so hot. So many issues were printed of any particular comic that it's the scarcity, the rarity is not there, you know. And people had that collector's mindset already, so they were preserving them. But you're older, your golden age, your silver age, there's always going to be that value. There's always going to be that scarcity because a lot of it was the mindset, the collector mindset wasn't really there yet. So a lot of people didn't really treat their comics like it was going to have value, you know.
Yeah. Even
And
recently, though, like I'd say about maybe 10 years ago, I think it was about 10 years ago, I bought a full run of Why the Last Man because I was just reading it in trade. It's something that Barb read, and she likes to read the trades, so I was just getting trades. I bought the full run for like cover price, you know, for the most part. And now it's worth a lot. 'Cause they're making it into a TV show and stuff, but like one is over $100, and two is like 63, and three is 73, and four is 59. You know what I mean? It's a lot of
yeah,
money.
that's true. It almost, in recent years, in the last couple of decades, because the comic market is smaller now, with the indie stuff, you kind of have a return to smaller print runs where you could see it with The Walking Dead, you know.
Yeah, this only had like a, I think it, if I remember correctly, a 14,000 print run.
Yeah.
So the demand is like really, really high, and it's there's not a lot out there. And then there's collectors like me who just won't sell. So it just increases in value because
Yeah.
there's limited people that are willing to sell.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, The Walking Dead's probably the best example of that because people didn't jump on it early, and when it was just a black and white comic, and Robert Kirkman wasn't really that big of a name. You know, you had these small print runs, and you have a rare occurrence where a comic actually grew and
I still find it
over
fascinating, though,
time.
just based on what it is, how it blew up. Because there was books out there that existed that are like that. But they never blew up.
Yeah, I mean, in the way it went from it would sell 20,000 copies and then it kept growing and growing and then it
Yeah.
get to like 50,000 and you rarely, if ever, see that kind of a phenomenon where a book actually grows, and not just in a small amount, but it grows by tens of thousands over time.
Yeah, that's a rarity. I think that and Saga and a couple others are things that actually grow their fan base instead of shrink.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I think that's one of the things that digital comics helps with is accessibility. People can go back and read and catch up on with the trades or with the digital comics, and then they can start picking up the print.
Yeah.
But all right, well, we're
Alrighty.
40 minutes in. We
Yeah, we haven't said anything about comics.
well, we've talked about comics, but we haven't gotten into our
Yeah.
features for the episode.
What do you want to cover
Still there?
first? Hello?
Yes. Hello.
I have to go mute because I had a cough attack. And
I gotcha.
it's funny how the audio goes when I do that because it's like at a steady volume, and then I cough and it's like choom, you see the spike. I did a Mike M's Weekly Reads when I was really sick, and with that one it was easy to edit though because I would just go to the editor and I would see the huge spikes, and I would just cut them out.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. But
Yeah,
what do you
that's
want to do
awesome.
first?
We could do our movie
Okay.
for their sort of our Halloween special. We watched From Dusk Till Dawn, and I had gone in and picked out a list of different Netflix streaming because we just kind of decided earlier this week to do this. And then you picked this from the list of stuff that I had come up with. And I don't think I've seen this. I think I've maybe seen a clip or two from it, but I really hadn't seen much of it. What about you, Mabel? Do you have something to say? She's like all of my face all of a sudden.
I could hear her pause or something clicking.
Yeah, she came
She's
in the room and she had a Kong with a treat in it. She was.
Yeah, I saw that she got the boxing gloves. That's funny.
Yeah, that was awesome. We were all super surprised and excited that, well, maybe that's what you wanted to say. You wanted to say thank you to Harley for your BarkBox. Yeah, that was awesome. She's already
Should
like,
have two more. It's like
yeah,
every
I
month.
saw it's a subscription. That was super nice of you guys. It's really awesome. She knew it was for her too.
Yeah,
Open
just
it up
like,
and
oh
she's.
my God, yesterday I got my DCBS box and Harley thought it was for her. So she was like on top of the box and she was ready to open it. And I'm like, Harley, you're gonna be so disappointed. It's not yours. You there?
Sorry. Yeah, Kara was asking me a question.
Okay.
Yeah, she thought your DCBS box was hers.
Yeah.
That's funny.
She was so disappointed.
Did she get the? I don't know. Do they do like the same
I
stuff
think
in each
they're
box?
different
She
because we
okay.
didn't get no boxing gloves.
Any boxing
I
gloves?
think it's got like a theme, like they pick a theme, like sports or whatever the hell it is, and. Oh, okay. Oh, I guess they have, they're based on the size of your dog.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the weight. Yeah, she picked the right size as far as Mabel's weight and stuff. It's kind of like the picture I sent you yesterday. I got both of them on the futon with me right now.
Yeah.
But it's less peaceful than the picture I showed you. This is
Well,
Mabel's.
yeah, Mabel was laying on the cat's back.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, he was on my lap and she had her head against my leg, but her head was also kind of against his back. But they were both sleepy, so it was peaceful. But just now she was trying to sniff his butt. She gets her nose right up in there and he's not happy.
Yeah.
As you might expect, he whacks her in the head.
Doesn't want her his salad tossed.
Nope. So, anyways, yeah, those boxing gloves, she already did a number on those. She found a seam, started ripping it. She's tough on toys. I think we need to start like a review blog where she rates how quickly she can destroy a toy.
Yeah, I try not to like Harley pulls really hard, so like if I play tug of war with any toy, she'll rip it like
Yeah.
almost immediately. So I try to like let her win. So
Yeah.
to keep the toy along, but I don't want to let her win because she thinks she's hot shit.
Yeah.
I want to put her in her place and say, "Hey, you know, I could win too."
Yeah, she needs to know his boss.
But there's an order in this family. Barb's the alpha, Harley's the beta, and I'm the Charlie. The lowest ranking one.
Yeah. I think I might be number three. I think I might have one up on the cat, but not in his mind. In his
Not in
mind,
his mind, he's number
he's the
one.
alpha, yeah. Just
Yeah.
like all cats. There's a really funny Geico commercial right now where the guy's sinking in quicksand and there's a cat there. He's like, "Go get help, boy. Go get help," like you would with a dog. And the
Yeah.
cat just sits there staring at him, like ignoring him. That pretty much sums it up. But yeah, anyways, back to our scheduled feature. So we watched From Dusk to Dawn, and I'm surprised I'd never seen this before. You said you have, right?
I chose it because I've seen it so many times.
I thought that might be the case.
I know it by heart.
Yeah. I'm surprised I haven't seen it because I've seen a lot of Tarantino and Rodriguez movies. And I think it maybe just happened to be just one of those things. I didn't see it when it came out, and then I just never got around to watching it. So I was glad that you picked it.
Oh, I
And
love it. I love it for 'cause it's like one of the only films that I think would come out of like something that me and Bill come up with. Be
it.
because it is like a reversal of themes. Do you know what I mean? It's like you got a serious type crime robbery type
Yeah.
movie, and then you just flip it on its ass and it's something else.
Yeah, I was gonna say it almost has two parts.
Yeah,
Cause...
it's almost like Quentin did the first part and Rodriguez did the second part.
Yeah, I had
Like
that suspicion too.
Grindhouse. Like
Right.
Grindhouse was Planet X or whatever that one was, and then the driving one.
Yeah, Planet Terror was Rodriguez.
Planet Terror, yeah. It
I
was
forget
very
the name.
very similar, except it was the same movie instead of two different ones.
Yeah, it's not as yeah, they weren't connected as directly.
Death Proof was the other one, I
Death
think.
Proof, yep. That's right.
Which I absolutely love that. I love
Yeah.
Death Proof. I really love it. Of the two, I think I perform the Quentin Tarantino style, but I appreciate the Rodriguez style 'cause he usually does more like the more outrageous thing, like
Yeah.
something that you would see in a B film or something, you know?
Yeah,
Like
they're kind of both influenced by the same era of film, but
yes.
they take different things out of it.
Different approaches, yeah.
Yeah. Like there's a lot of stuff in the first half of Dust Till Dawn, that comes from that era 70s film and stuff, but I agree with you, and you can kind of see that also. It's a good comparison to Grindhouse because you can kind of see that with Death Proof and Planet Terror too.
Yeah.
With like Planet Terror, you have like the machine gun leg, and there's
Yeah.
all these like really wild like
Wild things, yeah. And then you got, in this
action-oriented.
one, you have the dick gun.
Exactly.
It's got like the bullet casing is balls, and then the gun is the dick.
Yep, and Tom
And
Savini.
Tom Savini, which is, he was in the Dawn of the Dead. I mean, and he's a special effects artist.
Right.
So he's really a fascinating. You'll see him in a lot of films, like and just, but
Right.
he doesn't have like big roles.
No, but yeah, he kind of made the transition from being a big special effects guy to being in front of the camera.
And I'm sure, just based on his what he did in the past, that Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino like know this guy, and we're
Oh,
like,
yeah.
we got to get him for this film.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that in this film. A lot of casting that's
Yeah.
like they both, and not just in this film, but in their other films, have brought up a lot of actors that were big in the 70s, and both people like Savini and the other biker that's a vampire hunter in the Titty Twister, the
Yeah.
Fred Williamson,
Yeah.
his kind of like Savini's partner. He was a big actor in a lot of blaxploitation films.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you have better known, but also from a similar background, Cheech Marin is like plays like three different characters.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the basic story is you have two brothers, the Gecko brothers.
Rodriguez used him a lot too. Like he shows up in the Desperado films and stuff. Cheech
Cheech,
Marin, yeah.
yeah.
I love him too, especially when he's out there. You got the wet pussy, the stinky
Yeah.
pussy,
It's a pussy
hairy
blow off.
pussy, the shaved pussy.
We're slashing prices, half off pussies.
Yeah.
It's like smelly pussy, bloody pussy. You want, we got even got chicken pussy. It's like,
Chicken pussy. Yeah.
but yeah, like you said, the first half of the film feels more like Tarantino. Richie and Seth, which is Tarantino and George Clooney, Play Brothers, the Gecko Brothers, and I guess that is supposed to be a tribute to the Frog Brothers from
Lost Boys?
from Lost Boys.
I didn't know that.
If Gecko instead of
I
Frog.
wouldn't have seen the resemblance at all.
No, I mean, I think it's just kind of a name, that chose
Yeah.
Gecko as a tribute to the frog, but I just read that somewhere.
Oh,
But
okay. It's just the name influence. Like,
yeah.
we're the Frog Brothers, so let's choose something else, like Gecko.
Like a reptile,
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought it was like inspired by, but I'm like, these guys are like nothing like that.
Yeah, I think it's just the name.
The other two guys are like comic shop kids that are brothers that
Yeah,
know
kind of get
about
wrapped up in.
vampires.
Yeah. So you have them and Richie, played by Tarantino. He's a former rapist, sex offender, and so he's like the crazier of the two. And they're bank robbers, whereas Seth Clooney is more of just like a thief. Doesn't
He's a
isn't just
thief, but he
killing.
is really violent.
Yeah.
In other words, he has a little more logic to what he's doing than
Yeah.
Seth. Because
He has more
he,
anger.
yeah, this one kind of hears voices and shit. Like, he's got another voice in his head. And the one thing I want to point out is if you ever watch the El Rey TV show, they focus on that a lot more than the film.
Yeah, I want to now. I saw when I searched for this on Netflix, I saw that that first season's actually on Netflix, so I'm probably going to watch that soon
It's a
'cause
different look.
yeah, I
It's
got that
like
impression.
a very different look at it, but it's the same plot, but it's very different. Like, me and Barb were, we liked aspects of it, but there were other aspects that we thought, well, as a whole, the film did 1,000 times better. This one introduced some other concepts, but it's almost like you see Star Wars and then you see them put in the extra footage and it really doesn't add more. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's different.
Gotcha. But besides them, the other main characters are Harvey Keitel plays a former preacher that doesn't believe in God anymore because his wife has been killed.
That is an
And
interesting story right there.
yeah, interesting background.
That one
And
they really flesh out in the TV show.
oh, okay.
They flesh the hell out of that out. It's very different. I mean, it's very dark.
Gotcha.
They hint at what it is here.
Yeah, don't go into a lot of it. He's got his two kids with him, Juliette Lewis, and then I guess he's adopted his Chinese son.
Yeah.
I don't have the name of the actor that's written down here, but he's not really done much other than this. So it's kind of interesting because
But
it's a
he did
pretty
do
big
a good
role.
job if he's like new to the thing, you know.
Yeah,
He
yeah.
did what he was supposed to do really well.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have done much before or after. He's done a few other little projects, but I'm gonna look up his name while I'm
But
talking.
Juliette Lewis has done a
Oh
ton
yeah.
of shit.
Oh yeah.
George Clooney's done a ton of shit. And Quentin Tarantino always shows up in his own films.
Yeah. Yeah, and he actually wrote, or at least co-wrote this, besides starring in it, whereas but he didn't direct it.
Yeah.
Though you can tell he wrote it because, or at least wrote most of it because his foot fetish is
Yeah.
definitely at play.
Oh, big time at the strip club.
Yeah. But even before that one, so basically Keitel and his kids,
Does he
they
really have a foot fetish? Because now that you said it, I could see every movie having that foot.
it's
Like
I mean,
even
I
in
don't think
Death
he's
Proof and stuff,
right.
like.
I don't think he's come out and said it, but everyone basically kind of accepts it as true because there's so much evidence to support it. I mean, every single one of his movies. I mean, you watch like any of the movies, like the Kill Bill movies, and the number of times that Uma Thurman's feet are on screen,
Yeah.
and she has particularly big feet. But it's almost like, but like you said, especially once they're in the Titty Twister and And Salma Hayek is stripping. She's
Who
it's
also
just
really got her career started based on this movie.
yeah.
Like,
Oh,
this
and
was
she.
one of her first films, wasn't it?
Well, I think was Desperado was before this, wasn't it? And she was in that, I think.
What was she in Desperado before this?
I think she was in.
I thought Desperado came after this, but you're probably right. Well, Desperado is like a trilogy. The first
Right.
movie is like El something, which was a really El Mariachi was the very first one, which I
Right.
have never watched. That one is the one that kind of kicked off Rodriguez's career because it's like his Clerks. It was
Yeah.
very low budget. He made a ton of money and allowed him to have success, just like Kevin Smith's Clerks.
Yeah.
And then he got Desperado, and then he got the other Desperado.
Yeah, actually, Desperado was just the year before this. So right
Oh,
around the same
okay.
time, and she was in that,
I
but
thought
not
this was her first one. I guess because I saw Desperado after it.
Well, and I don't know that she was as big of a name. It's just like me. I mean, he'd been acting for a long time, but he had done a lot of TV
Yeah,
before
Roseanne.
this, you know, and he wasn't really the mega star that he is now, you know, where he's just on like another level.
Yeah.
But yeah, the two of them, they want to get the Gecko brothers want to get into Mexico, and so they basically end up encountering and using Harvey Keitel and his family. They use their camper and hide out in their camper to get across the border. And I was pretty amused by Clooney because he gets super excited when they get across the border. He's jumping around and he's everybody's friend all of a sudden because he's so
Well, that was his goal, and he met his goal, so he's like, let's celebrate, you know, kind of thing. But he's also trying to keep his brother. He also knows his brother's ape shit.
Right.
Like even when Jessica, what is her name? Juliette Lewis. That's
Thanks, Barb.
Jessica Lewis. Yeah, thanks, Barbara. Even when she's there, he's like looking at her, you know, and he's like looking at her lips, and the camera focuses on her lips. And looks down at her, you know, like he's sexually already mapping her out. And Clooney knows that he's doing that. And he's like putting him in check every now and then, you know?
Yeah, because prior to this, the brothers they're hiding out in a hotel room and they have a hostage, just like an older, kind of average-looking, middle-aged woman,
Bank teller, yeah.
bank teller, and Clooney leaves him alone with her, and he comes back with food, and the door of the bedroom's closed, and he asks, where is she? What happened? And he's quiet and doesn't say anything, and he opens up the bedroom, and the woman's dead, and a lot of her clothing has been removed. So, yeah, I mean, Richie is very dark, messed up character, and as you said, you kind of see things from his perspective when they meet, when they go into the hotel room of Harvey Keitel and his son are the only ones there. And Juliette Lewis comes back in a bikini and stuff, and you see it from his perspective. She's not saying anything for real, but from Richie's perspective, she looks at him and comes on to him. And later, when they're in the caravan, you realize he genuinely thinks that she said something to him, like he genuinely thinks she hit on him, and she doesn't know what he's talking about. So it's not like he's just fantasizing it. He genuinely thinks he saw her come on to him. And yeah, he's pretty messed up. But so there's the reason they go to this titty twister bar is because Seth, George Clooney's character, has a contact set up, and they just kind of have to hang out there overnight until their contact shows up in the morning.
And I truly believe, though, that he was gonna keep his word. Like, if we make it till morning, whatever, and everything's cool, I'll let you guys go. I really think he was gonna do that. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the impression I got. I think, like,
He wasn't gonna kill that family. He was gonna let them
no,
go.
because Seth isn't psychotic. He's not Like, he's not against killing, but it doesn't seem like his goal is to kill people. His goal isn't to hurt people. His goal is to just make money and be a thief, basically.
He is violent as hell, though. Like,
But I think the violence comes out more of like an anger issue. Like
yeah, but
his
like, did
intention.
you touch me? Like when that one guy touches him and he
Right.
punch him right in the face, Get your hands off me. He's
Yeah,
like
he's.
fear. He is fearless. Like he thinks he's invulnerable. At least I
Yeah.
get that impression.
Yeah, he's got an anger issue, but he's not going to go in just he's not like a serial killer. He's going to intentionally plot and plan out to kill people, but he has some serious anger issues, so if somebody messes with him, he's going to hold a grudge and he's not going to let it go. Like you said, that biker, they have a confrontation when they first get in the bar, and Danny Trejo is the bartender. And he tells him, this is just a bar for bikers and truckers. You guys aren't welcome here. And things are getting escalated. And Harvey Keitel steps in and says, "Well, I got an RV, and you need a Class 2 driver's license. So technically, that makes me a trucker. So, and these are my friends. So, does that let us pass or whatever?" And so they're happy to let them stay at that point, but when they get back to their table with the bottle of whiskey, Clooney is still fuming over the situation, and his plan is to get drunk and then do something about it.
I can get the kids drunk.
And then he gets the
And
kids drinking, though, yeah. The
the
kids
one
drinking
kid, the
whiskey.
one, the boy is like ecstatic because he's a boy and he's like in a strip club and there's alcohol. And
Yeah.
he's like, bring it.
He's suddenly surrounded by naked women, yeah.
Yeah. What was
Yeah,
that bar?
he's.
He's the son of a what? Pastor, yeah.
Yeah, so he hasn't seen any of this stuff before. And
Which
it's
makes it
the.
even more exciting.
Right. And speaking of him, I meant to look up Ernest Liu, his name is, plays Scott Fuller. So besides this, he's not really. He's done some other acting, but only a few things here and there. And I think this is the first thing that he did. But yeah, so we talked about Salma Hayek already. She plays Santanico Pandemonium. Mamacita. Everybody in the place is just completely transfixed by her as she does her
It is an
dance.
amazing dance that focuses a lot on the hips and the movement. And then that's when you get that scene where Quentin Tarantino, she like gets champagne and puts it like drips it down her leg and into his mouth through her foot.
Yeah, puts her foot right in his mouth, and I can just picture him like sitting at home in his typewriter, like, "Yeah, this is the
This
part where she puts his foot in her
is
mouth."
and then he's like Daryl and he's like, I gotta go take care of something real quick.
Salma Hayek definitely has the hips for the part. That's for sure. And but she basically turns out to be the first vampire that's revealed, and this especially is where it kind of takes a turn towards more of a horror movie with the vampires. I mean, you can kind of mark it when they get to the Titty Twister as the start of this time period, but especially when it gets after her dance and she reveals herself to be a vampire, and that pretty much all the strippers in the place are vampires.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. As soon as they arrive there, it's almost like they shift scripts. Like, okay, now we're in Rodriguez's world.
Yeah, now we're in the
It even feels
part.
different. The only thing that's consistent are the characters, right? The situation just changes. The tone of the film and the situation just changed dramatically.
Yeah. And a lot of people die pretty much straight out. Like there's a huge battle, a huge fight, and a lot of people die. A lot of the bar patrons and the number of extras diminishes very quickly. And Danny Trejo also reveals himself to be a vampire bartender. A lot of the people in here, I mean, you could definitely tell This is from 96, you know, they look a lot long, younger. Trejo, he looks younger, I thought. And two bikers that end up fighting along with the rest of the regular cast, as we mentioned, is Tom Savini and Fred Williamson. Savini goes by Sex Machine because he's the one that has the penis gun.
Doesn't he have a whip too, or am I thinking of somebody else? There's one scene where he has a whip and he just like whips the person by the neck and brings them over.
Yeah.
I can't remember if that's that guy or the other character. The other guy was just extremely strong. He was like throwing
Yeah.
vampires around and
Yeah.
he's really tall and big, like.
Yeah. Williamson. Well, I think he played football before he was an actor in the 70s. Eventually in the fight, Tom Savini gets bit and turns. There's a part where Williamson is monologuing, telling this long story about when he was in the war and stuff, and while it's going on, you see in the background that Savini is turning into a vampire. And these are ugly vampires. This is not, you know, your Twilight vampires. They're not as nasty as the Strain vampires, but they're not pretty vampires. But
Well, they start off pretty.
yeah, when they're in their vampire form, though, they're not
They're really
pretty.
not vampires either. They're
How so?
sort of vampires. They're more
Yeah.
related to snakes. You learn that later.
Oh, okay. Is that more like the mythology from the show and stuff that they get into, or?
Oh yeah, big
Yeah.
time.
Yeah. But there is a problem. Once they kill all the vampires that are in the actual bar, there's a problem because all of a sudden they realize there's a whole bunch of bats coming at the place, and they're trying to fortify it against the bats getting in. But Harvey Keitel, he ends up getting bit. And you have kind of these little Rodriguez things, like we already talked about the penis gun, but they also talk about how they, as a preacher, if he believes again his belief, he could pretty much take anything and turn it into a cross. So I thought it was neat that he has a shotgun as one part of the cross, and then a stick through the pump action of the shotgun. So it's essentially a cross, but he pulls down on the stick to pump it
And
and
that's
shoot it.
why I don't like the TV show though, because it in this movie it makes it like a vampire because of the cross. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the cross
Didn't they
actually
even have
powered.
like balloons where they filled with holy water and he blessed the holy water? So
Yep.
they would like they had these balloons, they put holy water in them, and then he blessed them, and they were throwing them at him, and it was like it was affecting them.
Yeah, the Juliette Lewis also has a cross around her neck, you know, preacher's daughter and all that. She uses that, and that affects them. And as you said, they have water balloons, and they kind of show her up. I think we kind of skipped over the fact that Tarantino's character gets killed. And so it's pretty much down to both Savini and Williamson get changed and killed. So it's pretty much down to Harvey Keitel, his two kids, and George Clooney. And Keitel gets bit. So he tells them, you know, I'm going to help you fight your way out of here because the bats get in. So they have to fight a whole bunch of vampires. But when I turn, you have to take me out. And he makes the kids promise that they'll do that. And yeah, the weapons, so they get all weaponed up and everything and ready to fight. And his son has the water balloons, and he also has a squirt gun filled with holy water. And the reason Keitel can make it holy water because his beliefs kind of come back that again.
The son's the
But
next to go.
his son's the next to go because when Keitel changes, he can't work himself up to it.
You
He
can't
can't bring
shoot him or
himself to
can't
shoot him.
affect him.
And so because of that distraction, he gets torn apart. And Keitel change has changed. So in the end, it's only Clooney and Juliette Lewis that make it out. And they
And then they meet with the guy that's supposed to meet with them.
yeah, finally. Finally, after a very long night.
And doesn't she take off sep don't they go their separate ways?
Yep.
In
Yeah,
other words,
part of the
she gets in the what do you call it, the camper or the mobile home,
Right.
and he drives off in the car.
Yeah, she wants to go with him, but he tells her, no, you don't want to go where I'm going. And he says something about El Rey.
Which is interesting because it's the El Rey network was formed by Rodriguez.
Right, yeah. It's almost like that's one of the things, him saying that, and then the way that the movie ends, which it pans out, and the camera rises up into the sky, and you see that the Titty Twister is actually on a cliff, and the entire backside of it is this Aztec temple. And those things are things that suggest, that they planted there to kind of maybe expand upon later. I mean, there were two sequels to this, but as far as I understand, like, they're not really super connected, and they're
They're
only kind of.
not super connected, but they're good. I think they're worth watching.
Yeah. But though I guess they're only produced.
They're not terrible. As you go on, they get worse. So the second
Yeah.
one's better than the third, and and sometimes in the superhero movies, the second one's the best,
Right. But I understand they kind of expand on a lot of that stuff in the TV show, maybe.
They do,
But
but I when you watch it, I think that you're gonna like the way the film did it better. Like why are they changing it? Your mind will start thinking about it, like why is it like this? And some of it makes more sense, especially with is his name Richie? Which is the character that is Quentin Tarantino?
yeah,
Seth.
Richie.
Oh yeah,
Richie
Seth
and
is
Clooney is
Clooney.
Seth.
So Richie is the one. You learn a lot more about why he's a little more. He's doing a little more wacky shit, So
It sounds like there's positives and negatives.
yeah, there's positives and there's negatives. I do like the more of the backstory about the preacher too. Like that was kind of cool because you learn why he lost his faith, and you physically see the incidents, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad I watched it finally.
Yeah.
Kind of our contribution to the month of October and Halloween and all that.
Yeah, me and Barb watched that movie like so many times. I think I've seen it almost as much as Star Wars. Empire Strikes Back. Because it's one of those movies that plays a lot, and we always
Yeah.
stop on there.
Right. Yeah, I'm surprised I've never seen it. It's just one of those things because I've seen most of their other movies, the two,
I think
Tarantino and Rodriguez, but.
Barb and me are Rodriguez and Tarantino fans. Like, I would say 90% of their films we go to the theater and pay for it. To go see it. Like when Tarantino comes out with that Western in Christmas time, we'll be at the theater.
Yeah.
We are Tarantino fans. I mean, there's movies that we like more than others, but
Sure.
we always enjoy their films. And Robert Rodriguez, I think I've enjoyed all his films. I have. What has he done lately? I know he's done Machete and Machete 2. I think Machete 2 is the last one I've seen, but if he's done anything after that, maybe I haven't seen it.
I don't think he has. Well, I know Spy Kids, that's like your favorite movie, right?
Well, that's the only one I didn't watch. Like I'm like not interested whatsoever in that.
Right. Well, I think he pretty much does those to make money so he can make the other stuff.
Yeah.
I think I've always heard
Well,
that.
I love Machete. Well, I'm a huge Danny Trejo fan too, so
Right.
it's like if you look in my office, I have a Danny Trejo poster that has the different moods of Danny Trejo. But
Nice.
yeah, I like their styles. I think it's because when I was a teenager, I watched a lot of the films that influenced them. Like that was something like I'd hang out with the basketball team and we get these really bad B films and grindhouse movies, and that was like the thing that we would do and laugh, you know, and watch these things. And I think that's why I like those two guys so much, is a lot of the films that influenced them we watched.
Right. It
And
looks like
I
Rodriguez.
love Grindhouse. Like I love Death Proof. I love how they scratch the film so it looks like you're at the drive-in. Like I felt like I was in the drive-in theater when I went to the theater to see Grindhouse. It even had the popcorn things and the things that you would see in the drive-in. It was not just a movie for me. It was like an experience that I remember because we had drive-ins. They're few and far between now. They still exist, but they're hard as hell to find now.
Yeah, we actually have one that's about half an hour from us. It's just a matter of getting there and staying up late enough to go nowadays. But I mean, they show modern movies, but yeah, and I was a little young to really experience the heavy drive-in period that you're talking about. I'm kind of nostalgic for it without actually having experienced
It
it.
was a awesome experience. I had some, like, me and Barb went to the drive-in a couple times, and then I went with my friends on the basketball team, and that was funny because my friend would borrow his the van, and then all of us would hide in the seats, so he paid for two tickets, and there was 14 of us under the seats.
Oh
And
my
it was the
God.
most uncomfortable thing ever. Like
Holy
I
cow.
remember my friend, I had my friend's hair in my mouth. Like I couldn't get it out. It was like right in my mouth 'cause we were all stuck in there and it was like you couldn't move. It was like if you're claustrophobic, you wouldn't survive.
That's a lot of people. I was thought you were gonna say, four or five or something.
No, it was bad.
Good thing I've seen pictures of your basketball team. Good thing you were skinny back then.
Yeah.
That's funny. So yeah, that was a good movie. I'm glad I watched it finally.
The other thing that I want to mention, since we're on the horror thing, this will just take a second, is me and Barb got to go visit the Stanley Hotel,
Oh yeah.
which inspired Stephen King to write The Shining. The Kubrick film was not filmed at the Stanley Hotel, but
Right.
it's Stephen King actually stayed in room 217, and that's where he had all these weird dreams and stuff that inspired him to write The Shining. And then the second film, which was closer to the book, was actually filmed at the Stanley Hotel. But it's really cool that, you know, went on the ghost tour and everything and got to experience a lot of the Shining paraphernalia and stuff like that. It was really cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Plus, I it was the first time I ever saw the Stanley Steamer car, because Stanley Steamer, he had the hotel. That's what it's named after.
Oh,
And
okay. I didn't
it's
know that.
actually engineering-wise, it's a fascinating car to look at all the levers and shit, because it's like powered by water and gasoline. It's such a weird
Right, yeah.
contraption. Yeah.
Steam-powered
Yeah,
vehicle.
steam-powered.
I saw a couple Chrissy steamers this morning
Yeah,
in the toilet.
I'm sure you did.
That is really cool. I would like to do that someday. The Shining is one of my favorite books. I've actually read it a couple times.
And it was like a cool, like, the one thing that we were doing, like, it's like old as hell. Like, every time you take a step, the floors just creak. The bathroom doors and everything just creak. It's just a creepy experience. And it's weird because the rooms are like, they're not in sequential order. Like, we were looking for 217 and we couldn't find it. You know, like, we're going, okay, 216. Where the fuck is 217? Where the fuck is it? And we were supposed to actually, we went on the ghost tour at night, which was at 8:30 at night, which was a lot of fun. We didn't see anything or anything,
Yeah.
but we saw a couple of doors creak, close, but the physics of, I got to play with the door afterwards. After everybody left the room, I started playing with the door. And I was like, this, I believe this is true physics that is causing the door to close.
Oh, yeah, of
But
course.
we were supposed to go, and this was the most frustrating part of the whole tour for me, is we got all pumped up, is we're going to go into the room where where Stephen King wrote the book. We're going to go into room 217. And what we did get is we got like this long explanation about this woman that worked at the hotel that burned and died in room 217 and haunts the room. And then we're going to go in the room, and then we're like, okay, I have this key, and it doesn't fucking work. So he lets us all play with the key to see if we could get in and talk to Miss Wilson to let us in and all this bullshit. And then he goes, ah, fuck, I can't believe they gave me the wrong key, so I'm gonna go back and get the right key. And then he comes running back with another key, and then he can't still fucking get in the goddamn door. So I think it was like a setup, because if they wanted to get in the fucking door, they'd get us into the fucking door. So yeah, it was weird. But it's weird, is you're looking at all these things and you're trying to see ghosts and shit, like images move, and I didn't see nothing. There was a couple times I saw these lights, but I could explain them. Like, people were looking at them on their phones and shit. I'm like, that's the exit sign reflecting over on this floor backwards. But no, it's a red blur. No, it's the exit sign, and your camera's picking up the light. But yeah, we got a little distracted, but it was awesome. And we saw a lot of elk and moose and stuff, and it was a lot of fun.
That's cool. Yeah, I remember the first time I read The Shining, we were on a family road trip to Florida. That's part of the reason I bought The Shining. I got The Shining and Misery, and those were two of the first adult books that I read.
Misery
And
was the only Stephen King one I read, and it freaked my shit, because it's like, it's more of a man's internal horror,
It's not supernatural, really. It's
Yeah.
just, captivity.
I never read The Shining, but I thought the film, when I saw it, was almost the most scary thing I've ever seen, because it's the transformation of a man who's sane to somebody who's, loses his marbles and wants to kill his family. And then the whole thing that scares the shit out of me is you're there the whole winter time by yourselves. I mean, it's like total isolation in a hotel that's huge, And it's like terrifying. And then you got this boy who's like, he's got a voice in his head, and he's got like powers that he could see stuff. And that's what the thing is called, the shining. It's the ability to see that. And it's like, you got Scatman Crothers, this character who's like, you have the shining. He talks to the boy through mind, and he's not even talking. It's like, you want some ice cream? But we saw the movie like 25 times, I think, because it's playing 24 hours at in the room.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. And I kind of wish they would have altered the films, though. Like, they would have showed us the Kubrick film and then showed us the one after it with the guy from Wings, because I would have liked to see, because you never see that one hardly ever. You know what I mean? It's just not, it doesn't have the play time or anything. They show the Kubrick film like Halloween time all the time, but you very seldom see the other one with the guy from Wings, Steve Weber. But I would like to, I remember seeing that, and I was like, the maze and the animals coming to life, because in the Shining, they have the maze of the hedges. And it's funny, because this hotel is trying to grow one now. They started it last year, so it's like this maze of hedges, and you can see over them. They're like, they're the size of your knees. So what they're hoping to do is grow the hedge so it'll be an actual maze. but it's going to take a while to get there. So they had a designer come and design it. Nowhere near the difficulty of the maze that's in the movie. I mean, it's not even close, but it's really cool. But we did have a hairdryer experience, right, Barb? Why are you laughing? That was terrifying. There was a hairdryer in our room. Okay, it was underneath the sink or whatever, in the one of the drawers. And then Barb goes later on and says, "I'm gonna have to call the room to, 'cause there's a ha no hairdryer." And I was like, "There was a hairdryer there." And Barb said, "No, there wasn't. You're shitting me." And there was a hairdryer. I saw a hairdryer. And then so she calls the room later on, and they bring us a hairdryer. And then we come back from the tour, and the hairdryer is on my pillow. I'm like, what the fuck? What the fuck happened?
Uh-oh.
Yeah, there's something going on with the hairdryers at Stanley Hotel.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Barb laughs at this, though. She thinks it's a joke. She saw
That's
the hairdryer on
suspicious.
my pillow. Was there a hairdryer on my pillow, Barb? Yes. Did you put it there, Barb? See?
Maybe the hotel controlled her.
I don't know.
And she doesn't remember that she did it.
Yeah.
That decided to possess the woman this time instead of the
We
man.
got to see the actual typewriter that was used in the film.
That's cool.
And then they had part of the house that was used in the second film. And they had the axes that he used.
Nice. Yeah, I like the Kubrick movie. There are a lot of differences from the book,
Yeah.
but and some people prefer one or the other because of that, but I like both of them. I mean, I think the film, it's its own artistic vision, and it still conveys, I think, the main themes of the film, or I mean the main themes of the book. And I think, like you kind of nailed it, that one of the main things is that it deals with a father and husband who it's well established in both the film and the book that he has struggled in the past with his drinking, and he had an incident where he abused his son physically because he was angry and drunk. And you get the sense that he really wants to change, and he is really working hard towards not letting himself go down that road again. And the whatever you want to call it, an evil spirit or dark forces in the hotel manipulate him so that he becomes, in a lot of ways, his worst nightmare, you know? And he becomes exactly the thing that he tried not to become. And I think that's one of the, it was interesting reading it again as an adult, you know? I mean, I'm not a father, but reading as a kid, I had one perspective, and I was afraid of a lot of the like supernatural things that happen in the book. But reading it again as an adult, I really connected more with the horror of this man being manipulated to fail, and do the exact opposite of what he wants to do, is to go after his wife and son violently, you know. And I think the movie conveys that. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah,
But
it's a creepy, creepy film. The part that creeps me out is that Shelley Duvall character locks him up in like the cannery, like where they have all the canned food and stuff. And the fucking entity lets him out. Like he's locked in and he manages to get out. So it's like it's such a good film because at that point you're thinking, well, this guy's just losing his mind. He's seeing this ghost of a person that already killed his two daughters and his wife, right?
Right.
And he's seeing all that, but at the same time, he physically gets knocked out and put into the a locked freezer. Well, not a freezer, but where the cans and stuff are. and it can't open from the inside. And that entity lets him out, and you're like, oh fuck, this is not just at that point you're like, is he seeing all this because he's drinking again, or you know, is he falling into this weird isolation hallucination, you know? But that's when you snap and you say, this hotel is fucking haunted, man. And then Shelley Duvall's character starts seeing shit. You know the boy's seeing shit, but you don't know if the boy's crazy or not, you know, at that point. You just know he has some kind of telepathy with that other guy. He has some kind of gift.
He's psychically in tune to some of the things that have happened in the hotel in the past, but and that's one of the things I think that people who prefer the book, Jack Nicholson's performance is so over the top when towards the end of the film that you kind of sometimes see his character listed with other movie villains and horror villains and stuff, but he's really a victim as well. You know, his character and the villain really is the
The
hotel,
hotel, yeah,
because
exactly. Wasn't it
there's
in
no
well,
alcohol even in the hotel. I mean,
but
it's
wasn't there something? Well, let me ask you this because I have not read the book. Is there anything or any mention in the book about like Indian burial ground or something that this hotel was built on, or is it does it never mention anything about the hotel other than the first murder?
That's a good question. And I'm trying to remember if that's I don't know that I can answer that definitively.
Okay.
Because
If it was
I'm
mentioned, it
missing
was
too.
subtly mentioned, then what?
I
It's
think it
not
might be
driven.
mentioned in the book too, but it's not, either way, if it is mentioned in the book, it's not extensively explored. But like you said, they do have the past history of the previous caretaker going crazy with the twin daughters and stuff, and that there's a history there of the house of the hotel having done it before. But really, I mean, he's intoxicated with the spirit of, not the literal spirits of as in alcohol, but the spirit of the hotel. But it he you know that scene where he's in the ballroom and he sees the ghosts of previous guests at the hotel, and he talks to the bartender that's not really there, and he feels drunk and he acts drunk, but he's not really drinking actual alcohol. But anyway.
Yeah, that was a tangent, but I forgot that that was, you know, it's related to like the Halloween theme, and it was a great experience. Like, if
It's all
anybody
retro too.
gets a chance to visit. The other thing that's retro is the what also was filmed in that hotel was Dumb and Dumber with Jim Carrey and what's the other actor, Barb? Jeff Daniels.
Oh,
So,
really? I
yeah,
didn't
Dumb and
know that.
Dumber was filmed there. Supposedly, there's a ghost story involving that where Jim Carrey left the hotel because he saw some kind of ghost, or yeah, he stayed in room 217 and saw something and left. I don't know if it's true or if it's just them fucking with us, but that was an interesting factoid.
When we drove to Florida, we drove halfway and then we're staying overnight, and I had just read the part about room 217 as we were getting close to our hotel for the night. I'm like, please don't give us room 217. Please don't
217.
give us room.
That would actually be scary.
I would
You
have
know, like,
been
what are the odds of that happening, you know?
exactly, and I think I was probably like 12. So, we didn't get room 217, thankfully. But so I think we had a few questions. There was one I believe was related to
Just to let you
Halloween.
know, I'm gonna have to take a break here after we do the questions, probably,
Okay.
because Barb is she's leaving me. No, she's leaving me for a week, so I have to see her off.
Oh, okay.
So
You gotta get your instructions
I
for
gotta
the
get my instructions. Yeah,
week.
let the alpha tell me what I need to do. But yeah, let me find the
That's
questions.
fine.
Okay, so from Joel Eustace, he says, I guess this is a retro bit. You guys talking about Bruce Dern made me think of some of the first sci-fi movies besides Star Wars that I ever watched. Bruce Dern was in Silent Running, besides Star Wars. Oh no, Silent Ru Running, an emo evil sci-fi with cute robots, and Enemy Mine. He said best movie ever. Zoonies. Do you know what that means? I never seen that. What are some of your favorites beside Buck Rogers? I've seen Enemy Mine, but that was nowhere near my favorite. That's kind of like a more of a talky sci-fi movie where two, a human and an alien kind of unite. I think it was Louis Gossett Jr. is the alien, and I can't remember who the human is.
I don't know either. I don't think I know of that movie, but I don't think I've actually ever watched it. I mean, for me, the obvious big one was Star Wars when I was a kid. That kind of eclipsed everything else. But I was trying to think of some other sci-fi related movies I saw when I was a kid, and first couple that came to mind were Flight of the Navigator.
I never saw that one.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of sci-fi. It has the kid from E.T. in it. I think isn't he the kid from E.T.? Joey Kramer.
Yeah, I think I know.
Or
I think
no.
I know of the film because there's like a device, like a circular orb,
Yeah.
in the plane. Like I've seen this movie, but I've only seen parts. Kind of like you were watching before. From Dusk Till Dawn, you said you saw snippets of it here and there,
Yeah.
but never watched. That's kind of like how I saw Flight of the Navigators. Every now and then I'd see pieces of it. Yeah,
Yeah.
I think it's the same kid.
No, actually it isn't now that I'm looking, but
He looks like him. He has the same
looks
haircut.
similar. Yeah. But yeah, he it's kind of sci I mean I consider it sci-fi. Like he ends up piloting a flying saucer. It's definitely a kid's movie, but I think I saw it again as an adult. It holds up. It's still a good movie. And another one that came to mind that's kind of sci-fi was Inner Space, which is like from a year later. It's kind of because I mean it's sort of sci-fi because there's technology where a guy gets miniaturized so that he can be kind of like the Atom does in DC Comics a lot, where he can go inside of another person's body to fix him. And then these are all kind of like quasi sci-fi, but the Short Circuit movies with Johnny
Yeah,
Five.
robot, yeah.
Yeah. The fact that it takes place in the regular world and stuff, but the robotics in it are kind of scientific. Ally Sheedy is
Yeah.
in that. Steve Guttenberg.
Yeah, I saw it. It's my first date movie.
So those are all for me, like came out when I was like 7 or 8 or so. Mid-80s stuff, so you were starting to get your Mac on, and I still was not interested in girls.
Interesting enough, that movie wasn't with Barb. she sighs. But for me, I guess it would be Battle Beyond the Stars with John Boy Walton. That was I think it's got somebody Vaughn. I can't think of his last name, but he was also in Magnificent Seven, and this is like the Magnificent Seven in space. And I would have chose this movie for us to watch because it was on Netflix like a year or two ago. Because I loved it as a kid, but I bet it's cheesy as hell now. It had a spaceship that had boobs on the bottom, but at least it was pretty. It wasn't intentionally boobs, but that's what it looked like.
Oh, okay.
But
Classic.
it was a serious movie. Where he has to kind of go to all these like aliens and mercenaries and stuff and try to get a team of people to fight off this alien invasion. And then the other one I'd like to plug is The Last Starfighter, which I absolutely love, which is a video game based. I know Campbell loves it. Like he's writing it. He loves it so much that he wants to do a comic book on it. And I'm a huge fan of The Last Starfighter too. I think it's amazing. Battlestar Galactica, the movie and TV show, that was another one that I watched. Obviously, Logan's Run, which we watched, and I watched the TV show there. Trying to think if there's anything else I could think of. Star Trek, which you're getting into now, the original series, and then all the movies, which I enjoyed. But that's my list.
Cool.
There's probably a lot more I can think of. That's what comes to mind. And then we had one other question, I think, that's in a different place.
It was I believe it was a Halloween or horror related
Oh yeah, horror
horror
related.
comics.
Yeah, retro horror comic.
Mine are all kind of ones that I've discovered recently. They're retro comics, but I don't think I actually read many horror comics when I was younger, but and I think I've talked on the show a lot. I definitely enjoyed. Whoa!
Sounds like somebody's at your door or something.
Oh, she's barking at something outside, I think. Oh, hey, my wife will take care of that anytime now. Tomb of Dracula, was really impressed with. I've talked about that on the show several times, and I think I talked about the Eerie anthology reprints. So yeah, I mean, I've discovered some horror comics as an adult that are older. There's some contemporary, like modern, outside of our time period horror comics that I'm reading. So it's definitely a genre of comics I like a lot.
For me, it was DC again, like Ghosts. That was like the first one I purchased with my own money. It was 20-cent cover. The Tales, House of Secrets, House of Mystery. Tales from the Crypt, but way late. Like, I discovered Tales from the Crypt DC Comics when the HBO show was coming out.
Oh, yeah.
I would say all the Marvel Bronze Age stuff, like Frankenstein's Monster, The Living Mummy, Werewolf by Night, Tomb of Dracula, that's all really good stuff.
You just got the omnibus of Werewolf by Night that came out,
Werewolf
right?
by Night, yeah.
Yeah, I want to read that because
And
that.
there's one for Frankenstein's Monster too, but it's
Is
not
there?
it, it's an omnibus, but it's trade. They didn't go with the
Oh,
hardcover
okay.
for it.
Yeah, I don't think that Tomb of Dracula is on Marvel Unlimited, but I don't think Werewolf by Night is for whatever reason, and
Yeah.
I'd like to check that out.
And then you had like superheroes that kind of crossed the domain, like Ghost Rider, which was kind of horror based, and
Yeah, I did read Ghost Rider.
Son of Satan. He was one of my favorite characters in the Defenders. He was the son of Satan.
Yeah, it's hard to get more
So
evil than
yeah.
that.
So yeah, there's some really good horror comics. Lately, it's Crossed and Walking Dead, and there's been a lot of like 30 Days of Night, I think, would meet the retro thing. Harley's gonna start going nuts because Barb's gonna leave.
Yeah, their girls are taking turns here.
She doesn't want you to go, Barb. No, she doesn't. She wants to go with you. No.
Yeah, Mabel, whenever she sees one of us leaving, she always runs to the door and sits down. She's a good girl and should be allowed to come with us.
Yeah.
That just makes it all that much easier to leave. Have this dog, big old dog eyes staring at you like, I'm good, I can come.
Yeah, let me go. So, I guess that leads us into comics.
Right, so you want to take a break?
Are you gonna be leaving, Barb? You're gonna make me feed the birds? Okay, I probably need to take a 10-minute break. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. All right, I'm gonna pause it.
Okay.
Remind me to start it again.
Okay.
Okay? All
So
right.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Talk
All right.
to you then.
All
All
right.
right.
We're back.
We're back.
And we gotta talk some comic books.
Time to talk about some comic books. And
You want me to kick it off?
you can go ahead and kick it
All right,
off.
I'm gonna go from lowest to highest. In other words, what I cover last will be the best. But they're all good. So the first one I read was from Archie Comics and Marvel Comics. It was called Archie vs. Predator. The creative team on this is Batten Lash. He was the writer. John Buscema did the Punisher art, and Stan Goldberg did the Archie art. So what you see is a lot of panels that focus on Archie and a lot of panels that focus on Punisher, and they switch back and forth, or pages anyway. And then when they combine them, it's like they're working off the same art page. But I had never read this before, and I've been into Archie a lot lately, so I thought I'd read this, and it's a pretty entertaining story. Punisher is chasing down this villain they call Red something or another, and man, does he look like Golden Age Archie. He looks like he's a duplicate of Archie, just an evil version of him. He's got the buck teeth like he does. Have you read the Fiona Staples one yet?
Yeah, the first
Yeah,
two.
do you know how they have the back matter? Archie had those big old buck teeth. Well, this villain that Punisher's chasing to try to kill looks like Golden Age Archie, kind of, but he's got more like an evil, like evil eyebrows and evil stuff going on. And Punisher and Micro are actually in this, and they're traveling to Riverdale to trace this guy down. But not only is he wanted by Frank, he's wanted by the local crime syndicate because he does things bad to other gang lords as well. And Punisher, it's one of those mistaken identity story. Punisher thinks this Archie is the bad Archie, and this goes after him to try to kill, and including the gang lords. They get involved and they hijack Archie and Jughead, and then Punisher finally realizes this isn't the guy he's tracking, and it kind of comes all together with when they have to it's it. The bad Archie, or the guy they call Red, actually goes to Veronica or Mr. Lodge's house, and he wants to set up like this criminal empire, so he pretends he's a rich guy, and Mr. Lodge falls in love with him and says, "Why don't you take Veronica to the dance?" She was supposed to go with Archie, but Archie had one of those weird situations where some kid was picking on him, and got one of those water guns and soaked him. So he grabbed the hose to soak the kid back, and he actually soaked Veronica. So Veronica got really pissed, and she's like, "I'm not gonna go to the dance with you." And then she ends up going with this other fucker that looks like Archie. And then Betty, I guess, was told that he was going to the dance with Veronica, so she went to the dance with Reggie, which is a bad mistake because I always like Betty more than Veronica. She's like the character that's way more likable. Like
Yeah, me too.
she has nothing to not like about her. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing as a person that you read Betty and say, "Well, that's evil," other than in like the zombie ones, and she might have done something bad, but in classic Archie, she never does anything that's wrong. Whereas Veronica is more of a me person, and she's spoiled because she always has money, so she never has to think about life at all. It's all handed to her. But yeah, the Punisher actually takes down that character, doesn't kill him, which is interesting because there's a lot of bullets flying in this. And they fight. He actually kidnapped Veronica, and the Punisher has to rescue Veronica, and uses hints from like Archie actually thinks he's helping with the situation. He thinks he's like the Jimmy Olsen to the Superman. And he at the end of the comic, he actually says, "Why don't you give me this watch where I could call you every now and then, like a signal watch." But And then it ha on the last panel, it kind of hints towards it has like a Wolverine scene, but it doesn't actually show Wolverine. But it says like Cerebro says you're the most dangerous mutant alive. If that's the case, I'm gonna have to find out what you're made of, Bub. And it's got a picture of some alternate Jughead, and he's going after Jughead. But it was an interesting story. It was one of those team ups that you never think would happen. And it started off as a joke. This came out in 1994. Either that or 1984. I can't read the writing very well.
Looking at the Wikipedia page, it says 94.
Yeah, 1994. And there's an intro on how it came to be, and it really started on the Archie side as a joke. And then him talking to Bat and Lash about it, and Bat and Lash was saying, "Yeah, I can make this happen." And then like a script was written and then sent to Marvel, and Marvel liked the idea, and they were doing team ups during this time with other companies, so they said, "Yeah, well, let's do it." And they really did it for money on one end, but I think it was somewhat successful for Archie. I don't think it sold like in the Marvel numbers, but for Archie, it actually came out as an Archie publication, and I think it did really well for them.
Yeah, I like how in the top left corner they have the price box and it has the
Yeah.
Punisher logo with Archie's face in it instead of a skull.
Yeah.
Skull eyes. But yeah, I didn't even know this happened. I didn't know that this existed.
It's a pretty crazy team up, but it makes a lot of sense. Now you see Archie teaming up with Sharknado and everything else, so
Right.
it
Yeah.
doesn't surprise you, but back then I think it would have.
Yeah, I don't think there was a precedent for it at the time.
It's actually titled, I might have said Versus, but it's Archie Meets the Punisher.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've been periodically picking up some of the Elseworlds annuals that DC did in 1994. So I decided to finally read some of them. And the first one I'll talk about is the Justice League International. It's annual number 5. And it story is called No Rules to Follow. It was written by Gerard Jones. And the penciler is Kiki Chansamoni. And that was not a name I was familiar with. I looked this person up. I wasn't sure if Kiki what Kiki was a name. Boy or girl's name, it's a boy. A man at this point. And he did comics work for a few years, but then kind of moved into other media, storyboarding and like working in the movies and stuff like that. And his style is very kind of the time. It definitely has a Jim Lee feel to it, almost as
Really?
if, yeah.
Well, I'm looking at the cover and it looks.
The cover might be by a different artist because it does kind of look different. It's not, the interior definitely isn't as heavily inked as the cover is, but then there's also four different inkers.
Oh, the cover is different.
So,
He's Chuck Wajekowicz. He's the guy who
yeah.
was doing the book. This was actually my least favorite Justice League incarnation.
Yeah, this, I mean, the art style, it's, competent storytelling. There is a bit of an issue in that there's a lot of two-page spreads, not splashes, but panels that go across the two pages. And the way that the panel layouts, they do cross over the seam. So, but it takes kind of a second to notice that because on the pages where it doesn't cross over the seam, the panels are all kind of miss in both cases the panels are designed similarly where there's a lot of panels that are off kilter. So there was a couple times where I didn't quite catch that the panel was spreading across the seam and read it incorrectly for a second before I realized. But otherwise, I mean, the storytelling is pretty competent. The style of the art, like I said, it's kind of has a Jim Lee style to it, but not as refined. So it wasn't the art wasn't my favorite part of the issue, but I kind of pushed through and got into the story as it went along. The basic premise with the Elseworlds is that in this case there's 10 superpowered beings, and because there's only 10, it's kind of like the 10 that exist all band together, whether their inclinations are heroic or villainous. And the early part of the issue kind of introduces you to a number of them. It actually starts out with Wally West, the Flash. His costume is different. It's still red and yellow, but he has sort of a helmet that's connected to the rest of the suit that looks kind of like an astronaut helmet. He's the first one you're introduced to, but then the other nine include Fire, Tasmanian Devil, Beast Boy, The Shark, Power Girl, Dr. Polaris, Dr. Light, Poison Ivy, Metamorpho. I think I might have gotten all of them. So the early part of the story is their early reveal to society that they exist. But it turns out it's all being narrated by Ralph Dibny, who's a reporter, and he's meeting, having dinner with Bruce Wayne, who doesn't appear to be Batman in this universe. And Dibny has written a book about the superheroes because they all disappeared after an incident where a nuclear reactor was melting down, and the 10 of them really couldn't do anything. They were about to fail. And then this just streak, a blur basically comes in and saves the day and then disappears. 10 of them are left wondering, there's something out there that's more powerful than all of them, but they don't really know who it was. And so then in the present day, Bruce Wayne, he funds this group to protect society from the superheroes in case they reappear. And five of them do in fact end up reappearing: Beast Boy, Metamorpho, Poison Ivy, Dr. Polaris, and the Flash. And none of them are going by these names. They just kind of refer to each other by their actual names: Rex, Wally, Garth, so on, Pamela. And the public just kind of refers to them by powers that they've displayed when they've been out in public. And the five of them, they're it turns out there's kind of like a break in the group of the 10 where these five are more interested in being proactive and they want to take down an army base proactively before the army can go after them and hunt them out. And they're confronted by a group, the group that Bruce Wayne has put together, and it's led by Ted Kord and Booster Gold. Again, they're not using the names Blue Beetle and Booster Gold, but they have costumes that are kind of similar, but more like there's more technology on their suits, and they lead a couple other individuals that are in like tech suits. So they have a battle with the five, and try to fight them off. Dr. Polaris is the one of the five that's kind of in the middle, in terms of his opinions about what they should do. And the other four convince him to go try to find the other five of their group and convince them to group up all together again as a 10 so that they can deal with the new group that Bruce Wayne has put together. So he goes to them, and it's Power Girl, Dr. Light, Tasmanian Devil, Fire, and the Shark. They're the ones that don't want to have the, take this aggressive approach. They're hoping if they hide out long enough, they're not going to be, that society will just leave them alone. So Dr. Polaris goes to them and says, "The others sent me here to convince you to fight with us, but I actually want you guys to help me stop them." So there's a confrontation between the two groups again, where they're trying to go on the aggression against Bruce Wayne and his group, and the other five appear to try to stop them. Well, things are escalating. While this is going on, Ralph Dibny and Tasmanian Devil head off to Antarctica, and they go there to find the blur that had appeared and save them from the nuclear meltdown. And as any comic book fans at this point are probably guessing, it's Superman or Clark Kent. And he's hiding out there, doesn't want to be a part of this world where superheroes aren't trusted. He's not even from the planet, so he's just been hiding out. They convince him to come back. And so he arrives in time as things are seriously escalating. There's a lot of scenes where there's in talk between the different heroes about their philosophies and stuff. And Poison Ivy, as you know, in the real DC universe, is a villain. It's actually her, and then more interestingly, Beast Boy and Metamorpho that are the three that are the most aggressive. And in this battle, they kind of take a turn towards the worse. And it's the three of them that Superman has to come in and prevent from taking things too far. So then, when he's successful doing that, there's a lot of media attention to everything that's happened. And because Superman saves a lot of people, the society and Bruce Wayne in particular are kind of finally turn their opinions towards the need to incorporate superpowered beings into public welfare and sort of not just hunt them down, but they're convinced that some superpowered individuals have good intentions. So they reform the 10, the group of 10, as the Justice League, but with Booster Gold, Ted Kord, Blue Beetle, and Superman taking the place of Poison Ivy, Beast Boy, and Metamorpho. And this is the first time as they're introduced to the public where they take on these code names that we're familiar with them having in the other universe. So, all things told, I mean, there were definitely some themes like hunted heroes, and like I said, the art style definitely feels kind of the time, and the character design, the different costumes that they have, how they differ from their regular ones, feels kind of 90s, but it was ultimately, as I kind of made my way through it, made for kind of like a 3 out of 5 read for me, where I definitely did enjoy it. I thought some of the interactions between the heroes were interesting. And I like kind of thinking about the idea of if there's only 10 or 11 superpowered beings on Earth, especially in the beginning, they're probably going to band together as a group. And then once you have that group together, the ones that have more of a villainous or have some kind of issues emotionally, they're going to start to show those characteristics. And it's easier to see those things when you have a small cast and you don't have, you know, this huge universe with tons of heroes and tons of villains that have these complicated interactions between them. You have this kind of small cast as kind of an origin story for this universe almost. That's, I mean, I think the negative, other than what I've already mentioned, is that it kind of takes a little while to get to that place. The first 10 or 11 pages kind of feel like they're just introducing the cast, and although that's necessary with an Elseworld, it kind of it could have been handled a little bit less by the numbers, I would say. So.
I have this book, but I'm pretty sure I never read it.
Yeah, this is the one I probably had in my collection the longest of the ones that I read.
They have a weird blue little bird looking thing that's like their Oberon.
Did they?
No, I'm asking you if they did in this Elseworld tale.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Were you asking me? No, they didn't really have anything like that.
Okay. Just curious because Gerald Jones loved that thing. Give him a lot of dialogue in it. It was the one thing that really annoyed me.
Gotcha.
It was like an alien blue bird. Matter of fact, I saw him. I finally finished the Hawkman. Remember I was closing out on Hawkman? I'm not going to cover it in this episode. But the last three issues by Christopher Priest were tied into this era of Justice League. It was the one era didn't they had like Nuklon and Obsidian, and it wasn't in their prime. Like this, they weren't very interesting at this point. And Wonder Woman and Martian Manhunter, Martian Manhunter ended up absorbing the gods, but that Blue Bird was in it, and he had a lot of dialogue.
Yeah, this is kind of getting close to the JLA relaunch with Grant Morrison, where all the Justice League books, where they had been revamped and were real popular after Crisis, they had kind of run their course and gotten bogged down, and it's kind of why
Yeah.
they ended up having to relaunch with JLA.
Right. But you ended up liking it enough that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it
Wasn't
helps that
what
it's an
wasn't
Elseworlds, and
yeah.
I could just kind of I could it was meant to be like a dinner thing, so
Sorry.
I could just kind of jump in and read it, you know. And it's not like it's playing off some of the things that were going on in the main book, but you didn't have to know any of that stuff, you know. And I could kind of already I still have familiarity with the characters that are in it, so I can still kind of jive on what they're playing off of.
Right.
'Cause that's
So,
what I do when I read comics. I jive. I
jive off of them.
jive off of them.
All right. So, my next book is going into the sci-fi realm, and it's from DC Comics. No surprise. 1983. It's a Mega Man number 4, written by Roger Sleifler, and artist is Keith Giffen and Mike DiCarlo. And the last time, I think I talked about it either in this or some other episode. I do so many podcasts, I don't remember. But it was the Lobo appearance. And Callista went off on her own. She was like, the Citadel had convinced her that she had to go back to her planet. And the shield was going to break down. And the shield wasn't broke down. They were playing with her mind and they were giving her false information. And she went over there and they hijacked her with this entity that kind of like sucks your soul and can become you. And on the last issue, I actually thought they killed Callista. They killed her. And Primus had no idea that they killed her. And Callista wasn't dead. It's just like this parasite that like sucks all your physical attributes and mental attributes. And it learns the secrets of, like, if you had any secrets about how the shield worked or whatever, it could learn that. And it sucked all that away. Callista and her and this entity fell actually from the sky, kind of down to the earth because the shield dropped. And the people of the planet wanted to save Callista. And the first time they go to save her, they save the wrong being because it's that creature that took over her. And Callista is almost like dead. She's like a plasma like being, and she almost hits the ground, but one of the guys catches her and like he's like in like a land speeder type thing and catches her in like some kind of like tractor beam and saves her from getting crushed. And the Citadel people are really pissed because the shields came back up and they didn't kill Callista. So they're like, you know, our whole point was to bring down the shields of this planet, Euphorix, and then attack it and take over the people there. And that didn't work out, so they're really pissed off. And meanwhile, there's this sexy cat-like creature that wants to mate with Tigor. And there's this other Demonia, who's that lizard creature that was in the last issue that was flirting with people, and she like has this pheromone powers, like she's ugly as shit. She's this lizard creature that looks awful, like something out of V, you know, the series. And they she's manipulating the whole team of Omega Man. What she's doing is she's mind manipulating them because there's a fraction. There's part of the Omega Man that want to follow Tigor. Tigor's got a real more aggressive state, like, let's go attack the Citadel. And then there's Primus, who's like, let's think this through and be more conservative. And half the Omega Man side with Tigor, and half of them side with Primus, and she's manipulating both of them, so they'll end up fighting each other. And there's a huge fight between Primus and Tigor, and Tigor actually almost like beats him to death, but pulls back at the last minute. He realizes that he's being manipulated in the mind. He thought it was Primus because Primus has powers, and he's thinking Primus is using the powers in his mind, but it's not Primus, it's the Demonia. So Tiger goes after Demonia and basically slaughters her. And then, but meanwhile, Demonia had called the Citadel and says, "Here's the location of the Omega Men. We're located here." She was betraying them, and they're on their way to the planet where the Omega Men are housed, and they're gonna attack the Omega Men. So, and Primus is beaten to a pulp. So that's how it ends, and that's kind of like the cliffhanger. So Primus and Callista are out of the picture because they're pretty much useless right now. And Tigor's got some of the Omega Men ready to aggressively fight the Citadel, and the Citadel's on the way to the planet to attack them. So it was a pretty good issue. I really enjoyed it. I've read a ton of Star Wars this weekend, like Dark Horse Star Wars, the Brian Wood Star Wars, and I've read the Matt Kent Star Wars, and I see similar themes, like with the Omega Men in Star Wars. Like, I could relate to this. Like, the rebellion is totally the Omega Men, and the Empire is definitely the Citadel.
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with the original. I've only read a couple issues of the original Omega Men run when it
Yeah.
crossed over with New Teen Titans and Starfire, but
I read a lot of it back in the day, but I'm rereading it because of the new Omega Men.
yeah.
So I enjoy it. It's really good.
Yeah, it's cool to hear about it. Who was the artist on that?
Keith Giffen.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. The next Elseworlds annual I did was Action Comics. It's annual number 6. And this is pretty much a John Byrne show. But it's pretty different. I was pleasantly surprised by this. So it's written, drawn, and inked by Byrne. I think, yeah, it's then Glenn Whitmore was the colorist. And it doesn't run the entire length, but it runs almost most of the annual. There's a short backup story I'll talk about briefly, but the story is called Legacy, and it's a takeoff on Superman, of course. But in this case, Krypton explodes, and the survivor is Gar-El, Gar, and he embodies a lot of things that were wrong with Krypton prior to it exploding. Prior to Krypton exploding, a lot of Kryptonians had turned inward, away from life and love, and unfortunately, Gar-El embodies a lot of that. And when he arrives on the planet Earth much earlier than Superman. He actually arrives in the 1700s. So he arrives to colonial America, and he's taken in by the Duke of Albion. Actually, I'm sorry, he arrives in England, but around the time of colonial, America. So, you have the people that the men wear the false wigs and stuff, and when Duke of Albion and his wife are attacked by this highwayman called the Raven, and he's about to rob them when Gar-El's spaceship lands, and he saves the two of them, and he's already an adult, so he incorporates himself into British society. He's come to be known as the Warlock Royale because the time, witchcraft and stuff is believed in, and so his abilities that he gets from the sun, like Superman, are thought to be from witchcraft, and he's a male, thought to be a male witch, therefore a warlock. So because of that, because England has him, the American rebellion is not successful. There's a scene where the founding fathers are meeting in Pennsylvania, and Benjamin Franklin and John Adams and whatnot, and they're talking about this threat of the Warlock Royal and how he hasn't appeared yet, but it's probably a matter of time. Well, sure enough, he arrives at the door, and they try to get him to talk civilly, but he tunnels underneath the building and lifts the entire building off the ground and takes them to the gallows. And there's just this dark scene in shadow where you just see these gallows with lots of bodies hanging from them. It's basically like the founding fathers have all been hung. So it fast forwards at this point 211 years. And young Kal-El is in a history lesson, and he's the great 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 grandson of Gar-El. Because they're Kryptonian, his great 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 grandfather is still alive. Gar-El is still alive. He's still in control, and the world still follows late 1700 British fashions. And they have new technology, new vehicles and stuff, but everyone still dresses in like a similar fashion. And we discover from inference that Jor-El, his father, was killed by Gar-El, his great-great-grandfather, for speaking out against Gar-El and the tightly controlled dictatorship that he's created. But because there's all of these generations that have married humans, Kal-El is pretty much human. He doesn't have any powers. And he ends up connecting with the rebellion. He goes on a raid with one of his grandfather's men to the Daily Planet. And that's where he meets Lois Lane and Perry White and whatnot. And he later discovers that Lois is part of a rebellion group, and that they have a piece of kryptonite, and that it can, and he's told that it can harm his great great grandfather, and it doesn't do anything to him because he's got so much human blood at this point. So he goes to confront his great great grandfather, and his grandfather's men shoot him. Through the bedroom window, and Gar-El's upset that his son has been, or his great grandson has been injured, even though Kal-El was there to hurt them. So they don't find the kryptonite that Kal-El has on him in his jacket until after he's been shot, and it's this fact that really gets to his ancestor, the fact that he had the means on him to kill him and didn't use it. And it's that selfless act that inspires him finally to what Kal-El couldn't convince him with his words. He takes Kal-El in his arms and flies off into outer space and decides to finally abandon the society that he's created, and the end of the story deals with. Lois hearing the news that Gar-El has finally left them. And Lois vows to lead them to create a society that's worthy of Kal-El, who bought the freedom for them with his life. So it was a really, really cool story. I mean, it's nice John Byrne art, but I also found it to be really well written. When I first started reading it, obviously I knew that they were kind of riffing on the Superman mythos, but when he landed in late 1700s in England, that's a pretty different take, and I liked how they interacted with the Daily Planet and the takes on Lois, and it's kind of one of the questions that raises is why are they all still living according to the same fashions and all of that, but there is a bit of an explanation that is addressed a bit because of it's part of the tight control that his grandfather thinks that he has upon the society, and he really thinks that he's brought order and brought and that he sees himself as a savior to this society, but he doesn't realize how he's stifling it and how he's taken the bad parts of what Krypton was before he left, and imposed it on the society. So it was really neat. I recommend it. There is a backup story.
Does it look like Burns' art did when he relaunched the Superman?
Yeah, I mean it's pretty high quality burn, I would say. I mean, it's maybe not quite as tight as the mid-80s. It's like a decade later, but it's not as loose as some of his stuff looks nowadays. I enjoyed it. It still looks good to me. It's well done. And then there's kind of a neat little, very different, but neat little story in the back. It's also an Elseworlds tale. It's the plot and art is by Dennis Jahnke, and the script is done by Louise Simonson. It's called Doomsday for the Fifth Dimension, and basically, I'll sum it up by saying it's like what if Superman landed on the planet where McSpidelik and his people are. So it's McSpidelik is the king, and Mitsplik and his people, they see Superman as Doomsday, and they keep calling him Doomsday, and they see him as a threat. But it's pretty clear that Superman, he doesn't mean to be a threat, and that's not his intention. But that's how they see him, and it's humorous and it's kind of fun. And their imps' efforts to get rid of stuff Superman back in the ship that he came in and send him back off out of their planet because they're mad at him stomping around creating potholes and craters and their nice lawns and stuff.
If you think about it, take a picture of one of the panels that's in there, like of the John Byrne art. I'd be really
Okay.
curious to see it.
Yeah,
Just
I'll
like pick
get
a
some
random
pictures.
page that looks pretty cool and post it on the Geek Brunch site or something.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do that. But yeah, I recommend you can get this. You can pick
Because
this
that's
stuff
like that, I
pretty
think that's
cheaply.
like late John Byrne, like after he relaunched
Yeah, this
it.
is the this these were the 1994 annuals.
Yeah.
So you're talking
It's way late.
about 8 years, I
Yeah.
think. Eight
He wasn't
seven or eight
doing too
years.
much work for DC, I think, at that time.
Yeah, I think it was kind of tailing off by this point. And it's not connected to anything else going on,
It's
obviously.
Elseworlds, but I just want to see what his style looked like
Sure.
that time. My last one is my favorite, and no doubt because it's the creator that wrote it and drew it, and it's Mike Grell Star Slayer, which you kind of been talking about indirectly because you've been reading the backups.
Yeah.
So my history with Star Slayer is I have none, okay? I strictly bought it for the Rocketeer backups. And the only Star Slayers I owned were the Rocketeer because I absolutely love the Rocketeer, so I wanted to have every appearance of the Rocketeer. And that's how I know Star Slayer. But I never read any Star Slayer and never really paid attention to it. But I've been on like this Mike Grell kick. Like I just read like Thunder Agents from DC Comics, and Mike Grell did some of the scenes, the flashback scenes, and I'm like, God, I just love his shit. And then I've been doing John Sable, and it's like nothing he does I don't like. And this is an interesting tale because I read it out of fucking order. I read number four thinking it was the first one I had. And this is a different imprint, by the way. This is the director's cut. This is the Mike Grell Windjammer from Acclaim Comics director's cut, one through four. And I read number four and I fell in love with it. I was like, I want to go read number five or number two because I thought it was number one. And I was like, this is a good intro, even though it was number four. It's like, it just kind of felt a little weird because they were already in space and they were going through things. And I'll get to what they were going through, but I thought it was just like a first issue. And it wasn't that jarring to me. I was like, okay, I want to read what goes on. Then I looked at the cover and I was like, this is number four. What the fuck? Do I only have number four? And then I went to the box that I pulled it out of, and there was one through three. Sure enough, I probably just filed them in the wrong order, you know? And grab number four is the first one. And so I went back and read one through three. And one through three, it's interesting how the story develops. Issue one is kind of them already in space, and they're going into a. Oh, God, there's some panels on issue one where. He draws this character. If I get another commission, I am getting him to draw Tamara, who's this scantily clad Star Slayer character from the future. And when I read this, it was so weird because I read issue four first, and I'm like, they're in space and they're on this Jolly Roger, which is like a spaceship, but it's got sails on it. It's very bizarre. And they're on this ship and they're looking through, you know, stuff, and he keeps on like cussing out Rome, like, you motherfucking Romans and all this shit. I'm like, what is he fucking talking about Rome? I was like, I don't fucking understand at all. And then I read issue one, and issue one's interesting because they're in space together already. And you get introduced to these characters and they're going to like a Mos Eisley cantina in space. It's a spaceport to get supplies. And they get in a bunch of fights and a bunch of brawls and a bunch of bar scenes. And the art is amazing in it, but that's pretty much the plot. Is they're just getting on the spaceport. They get there. They get into a bunch of fights and quarrels. And they're even in the bar though. There's a sexy ass creature that comes up to Star Slayer. His name is Torin. And I don't remember his last name, but it's like Torin McLeod of the Clan McLeod or something like that. It's like a Celtic name. And he's actually a Celtic warrior that got put into another English island. Like he was fighting for the English at the time or something like that. And but what it is, essentially, to make things simple, is it's a man out of time. And it's almost like Mike Grell couldn't get his Warlord property from DC that he created. And he's like, well, what could I do? Well, I'm going to make a Warlord in space. So that's what this is. It has a lot of that. And it has things of like Exo Man of War too, because he's a man out of time. And I wonder if like this might have influenced who was writing Exo Man of War originally, because that's a sent. He fucking hated the Romans, and he came from the Roman times. And the thing about that is, the issues two and three are the origin stories, and then issue four is showing them trying to find this jewel that that Tamara's looking for that could like fix things politically, and because the Earth is like almost dead. All the other planets have been destroyed. There were creatures on Venus that were trying to attack Earth because the sun is going supernova. It's turning into a red giant, which is means it's consuming shit, and solar flares are going over. So Mercury's gone, Venus is gone. Venus, matter of fact, they're like, fuck it, we're gonna all die. They're like Kryptonians, but they're not like Kryptonians saying let's stay and die, right? They get in their fucking ships and they said let's attack Earth and take over Earth, and they try to get there and the solar flare just destroys them all. And they get onto the ship tomorrow, and that, and they f this old ship that was going to invade Earth, and that's where they find the jewel, and it's attacked to this killer robot, and they have to take out this killer robot, and that's what happens in issue 4. And then his origin story is essentially he's a man out of time. He's in Roman time, and he falls in love with this clan's beautiful woman, and he has a kid with her. And when I read issue 2, I actually said, "Oh, I bet Star Slayer is the little boy," because the way I read it out of order and everything. But he wasn't the little boy. He was the man that was there in Roman times, and Rome was invading. They were coming over in ships, and he was telling the leader of the who was the daughter he fell in love with. Her father was the leader of the clan. And he's basically saying, Rome is not going to come over and just ask you for stuff. They're going to take it and they're going to make your whole people slaves. And nobody believed him. So he's like, well, fuck, I'm taking my wife and kid and we're going to go to the mountains. Anybody that wants to join me, and if they attack me in the mountains, in the forest, I will fight. I will fight for them. And so he gets there and then he sees that Rome did exactly what he said, and they were going to kill the father and all the people that he loved. And he told his wife and kid, he said, "You stay here. I have to go down there and try to save your father." And he goes down there, and he's a badass fighter, man. I mean, he could take out like fucking 20 Rome. So you could put 20 Romans on him, and he could take out 20 Romans. And then he essentially loses his eye in combat and doesn't even stop. His eye's gone. And he's like fighting and killing, and he's finally getting to the point where they're just going to overcome him with sheer number. Like he's just going to die. Not because he's like weak or anything, it's just there's too many of them. He can't take them all on. He's going to get a sword thrust through his chest, and he gets beamed aboard the space vessel, and he's like, "What the fuck just happened?" And Tamara's like, "I need you for this rebellion." She actually brought him into this the future. And she said, "The only reason I could bring you into the future is because you were dead anyway. I caught you right before you died." And he said, and all he can think about in the next few issues is like his daughter and his wife. I mean, his son and his wife. So it was a really good story. Art is amazing. And my next commission by Mike Grell is this tomorrow, if I ever get an opportunity. She is so smoking hot, man.
Yeah, that would be cool.
But it's a real, this is way better than I thought it would be. Like,
Nice.
and I can see that they redid the colors. That's probably why it's a director's set. It said they added on to the story. I don't know what that means because I didn't read the original source material. And it looks like they redid some of the art because it doesn't look as dot matrixy as 80s art did. But that could just be the colors. But
Yeah, probably.
it is wonderful.
It's always nice when something exceeds your expectations.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
Cool.
And you have them too, right? Or did you just get the Grimjack one and it is the Grimjack Omnibus and it's just Grimjack?
Yeah, it's just Grimjack. It doesn't have the.
Okay.
Yeah. The only full Star Slayer issue is the crossover one. But, all right, my last one is also a Detective Comics annual. Or it's also an Elseworlds annual, and as I just revealed, it's Detective Comics. And this happens to be annual number 7. And this is by Chuck Dixon. and Alcatena. I think I'm saying that right. And this is Pirate Batman, basically. This is really cool. Really well selected artist for this. But as I said, I mean, it's basically kind of Pirate Batman. He goes instead by the name Leatherwing. And he's a pirate down in the Caribbean area, I believe. His first mate is Alfredo. And he's Bruce Wayne, as is usually the case. But Robin also comes into it. He's kind of an orphan wandering the streets of Kingston Town in Jamaica, and he aspires to be a part of Leatherwing's crew, takes out some pirates that are on shore leave, and ends up stowing away on Leatherwing's ship when it leaves port again. And there is another ship called the Laughing Man, and you can kind of guess who the captain of that ship is. He's got a white face and a big grin. And he does go by Joker in this universe as well. And when we meet him, he has got a prisoner and he's interrogating him, trying to find out information about Leatherwing's hidden harbor. It's basically his bat cave in this universe. And he gets some information, but is still needs to pursue it further. Well, he ends up meeting with a third ship. And the Capitana Felina, who is, of course, Catwoman, and she has a similar costume to her early Catwoman costume. Not the original, but the like 80s, 90s era before the Ed Brubaker Catwoman. The perp, she's all in purple. She does have a cat mask and a whip. She and the Joker meet up, and he wants to recruit her to help him discover Vesper Tilio K, which is the equivalent of the Bat Cave. He has a scheme that involves her seducing Leatherwing, because it's known that women in distress have a power over him. There's a draw for him. And while this is all going on, Robin is discovered on the ship and pursued by some of Leatherwing's men. And because of Robin is able to uncover some traitors in their midst, that's kind of the thing that he displays his abilities. That's what Leatherwing convinces Leatherwing to allow him to stay. Meanwhile, Catwoman, or Felina, she pretends to be a woman in distress that's being, she dresses up in different clothing, and they stage a scene so that Leatherwing will see her walking the plank. And so he jumps, charges in, blade in his teeth, jumps in the water, fights off some sharks to make his way over to the other ship and rescue Felina and bring her back to his ship. And so she plays the damsel in distress, and pretty much everything's going according to Joker's plan. Batman, or Leatherwing rather, is falling for her. He doesn't reveal to her his identity. He keeps his cowl on. But otherwise he's trusting her more and more, and eventually leads her, or allows her to stay on the ship when they head into his secret harbor. But unfortunately, when they arrive there, there is a woman that Batman saved earlier in the issue from the Indies, and she is under the understanding that she is his wife because he bought some garments for her, because when he rescued her, she was not well clothed, and according to their traditions, she thinks that she's wed, and he hasn't really dealt with this issue, and he's fallen in love with Catwoman. Well, she sees this from a distance and gets upset, and she had up to this point kind of started to fall for Leatherwing, but this is what convinces her to go back to the original plan, to work with Joker. So she puts back on her regular outfit and disappears, swims out of the cave when they're not watching, and goes back to Joker. Reveals the location, and Joker and his men head off to the location of the secret harbor, and Robin ends up being captured by Catwoman on her ship. But it's Robin that kind of has the ability to talk Catwoman into realizing what she's done. He uses his words to convince her and let her know, that what she saw wasn't exactly the reality, that Batman's wife is not exactly his wife, and it's, he wasn't being untruthful to her. So there's a final battle that goes on between all the different parties. Joker and Leatherwing come face to face, and Catwoman switches sides again. So it ends kind of in a cyclical fashion, where there's a bit of kind of old style narration that opens the issue before it goes into regular comic book dialogue and captioning. But it ends again with some more of that old style, like, rhyming dialogue, as if it's a tale told from that same era. And it kind of comes full circle with some of the themes that are talked about. And so I found it to be really well written. And the art by Al Catania is a really great fit for this type of tale and the era that it's supposed to take place in. Lots of curvy panels, that are kind of alternated with your regular square bordered panels that evoke the art of this era as well. And the costume design for Leatherwing and Robin and Catwoman, Joker are all really excellent. So I'd say it's probably the best one that I read. The John Byrne one was really good, but this one it's just really fully realized. It's just really convincing. It's a good choice for an Elseworld, and it really, Batman and all the characters, they really transfer really well over to the different setting.
Well, in general, the best Elseworlds, in my opinion, are the Batman ones.
Yeah, definitely a well adaptable character. But one thing I was going to quickly mention is just in all three of these annuals, so it just happened to be at the time, there's a kind of a neat ad just to looking back at that time period, where they have it says that it's from the DC High 1994 yearbook, and it's basically an ad for five different
Sorry.
series at the time that featured teenage characters. You had Damage, the Ray, Anima, Superboy, and Robin. And each one of them has, like, what they were voted, their after school activities, a quote, and their immediate plans. And then it also has something like handwritten from one of the other characters. So I won't go through all of them, but just give a couple examples where for the Ray, his after school activities, it says not applicable, raised in a room with no sunlight and educated by nuns. Let's see. Superboy is voted cutest clone. And one of the things that's written on Superboy's pate or little strip is from the Ray. It says, "Superboy, nice jacket, but lose the spit curl. KIT, keep in touch, Ray." So there's those things for each one of the five, and I thought it was a pretty kind of a neat
Clever
little
ad, yeah.
clever little ad, yeah, for those books.
And I
And
have them
that's it.
all. I have all of
Yeah.
those. The only one that I have, I'm not real familiar with because I haven't read it, is the Enema.
Anima, yeah, Anima, something a little bit different.
I Enema.
Yeah.
It's what you makes you shit. But that character, I read the first issue and I was like, maybe it was Zero issue. I can't remember if that launched out of Zero out. But I didn't like it, man.
I don't think it lasted very
It
long, did
was
it?
bizarre. I still want to revisit it because maybe I just wasn't in the mood for it, but it was weird.
Yeah, I don't think that one was too
It
successful.
wasn't like a welcoming book. Like I just read a book I didn't like, which amazed me because I love everything. And I read Alien Legion, which has a retro following. Like it was a big epic Marvel book.
Right.
And I read the new one from Titan Comics. It was the most incomprehensible book I ever read, and it had an awesome creative team. It was Chuck Dixon and Larry Stroman, which Larry Stroman I remember from X Factor, like when he drew with Peter David. Like that's what I remember him from. He used to draw awesome Guido, strong guy, and Havoc and Polaris and stuff. And his art in this was perfect. But this was like, it was like season 8 of a book or something like that, where it like took off and you had no idea what was going on. It's just like a huge battle scene. You never get to know any of the characters. The only thing you get to know about the characters is there's like who's who pages on them in each issue. But in the story, you never get to know the characters. You can't tell one from the other, like what makes them unique or other than the who's who pages.
Yeah.
God, it was awful.
That's weird.
Yeah, I made it through 3 issues. I'm gonna read the fourth one, but I already know I'm not gonna like it. There's nothing they could do in the fourth one to
At that
win me
point.
over. It's like I know none of the characters. I don't have any idea what's going on in the plot other than a war's going on. The art looks nice, but man, I just like that's not inviting like at all to a new reader. And I kept on hearing like awesome things about Alien Legion. Like it was one of the best sci-fi books, like Omega Men, from Marvel Epic or whatever it was.
Yeah, I think that back, yeah. Not a good jumping on point then.
Was horrible. And it's weird. I'm a weird person because it's abnormal for me not to like a book. So the only time I read reviews is when I don't like them to see if I could learn something that I missed. What do other people see? I read 2 reviews and it was the exact same thing I felt. One guy knew about Alien Legion and said, "Man, I don't remember a lot of this stuff, and I can't imagine a new reader jumping onto this and even finding anything about it comprehensible."
It's really strange they took that approach.
Yeah, but it was the first Chuck Dixon book I didn't like ever.
Yeah, and he can still write. I mean, I just read a couple of weeks ago, I read the first issue of Black Tiger. It's a mini series from Graphic India.
Yeah.
And he did it with art by Graham Nolan, and
That's
yeah,
a great
it was
creative team. They just did another book for IDW that I just read. It was a Frankenstein book, something Frankenstein. I can't remember what the title of it was.
Joe Frankenstein.
Joe
I didn't read it, but
Frankenstein
yeah, but I
was the
know
same creative team because he worked a
I
lot with him on Batman and stuff. So he had Graham Nolan. Like I know that team and I know they work well together.
Yeah, and I only have issue one so far, but it's a 4 issue mini series, and I think it was originally solicited as a one shot, and then they decided to make it 4 issues, but it's It's from Graphic India, and number one was really good, and it was definitely accessible. And I mean, they're not, it's a new property, so they're introducing it, but me, Dixon can definitely still write a good comic.
Yeah.
So I wonder if he was told to just to make it
To continue
continuation.
it, like nothing, like you, all the people that are gonna read your comic are guys that have already read all of the Alien Legion. So
Yeah.
just go with it. This is
That's
where
like
you
you
left.
said.
This is where you left off. Go, just take off.
Yeah. But it's too
Go,
bad because I mean,
don't even
even if
give
you.
any backstory about why there's a good guy and a bad guy. Like, no backstory about that. It's just like
Yeah.
you're dropped into a fight for 4 issues, and you don't know what the fuck is going on. It's chaos.
It's a bad idea even if you do get your long-term readers of the property, because like you said, that one reviewer, he read a lot of Alien Legion, but I mean that stuff came out, the majority of that stuff came out in the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember what I read like 5 years ago, let alone
I can't remember from week to
30
week.
years
I
ago.
read like 50 to 40 books a week, so it's hard to
Yeah, sometimes,
remember.
yeah. Like what you read last month, you know. That's why
A
it's like I like
really
Marvel's
good book
recaps.
will stick out.
Yeah, I'll
Like if
stay
you
with
got a
that.
5 out of 5, I remember all of them. If I
Yeah.
get a 4 out of 5, I remember half of them. If I'm in the three out of five, which means I enjoyed it, I probably don't remember it all.
Yeah, but it made less of an impression on you probably, so it's not gonna stick with you as much. But this Chuck Dixon Batman annual, I highly recommend. It's definitely a good one. And that will be it for me for Geek Brunch
Retrocast.
post Baltimore, post
Yeah.
touching,
It's been a long time.
post embrace.
I think it was a month ago we posted our last episode.
Yeah, because last time it was before the con.
Yeah.
If the con wasn't that weekend, that would have been a weekend we recorded, but
That's why we had a lot of stuff to talk about before we
yeah.
even started.
Right.
All right. Well, you have a good one, and you can reach us at Geek Brunch Podcast on Facebook. Our webpage is geekbrunchpodcast.com. You can leave comments on the Geek Brunch Facebook page or the website. iTunes reviews, we could use some of those. And I'm at Mike Myers Brunch, and Chris is at MythMakingETC. He also does From Kid to Flash. I think he put out a episode last week, right?
Think was it either that or 2 weeks ago? I can't remember.
Think it was last week because
Yeah.
it's the time I put out Mike M's Weekly Reads.
Yeah.
What else did I forget? Emails, mythmakingetc@gmail.com and Mike at comic book.
Yeah, and I did go ahead and posted three pictures of the John Byrne art.
Yeah, I
So
liked
that's
them. They
up
were.
there on the Geek Brunch podcast page.
That's good stuff.
So,
I didn't think it was different at all.
no, it looks pretty solid to pretty comparable to his 80s work.
It's a very strange cover for a John Byrne book.
Yeah, it's actually a Mike Mignola cover.
I'm not a fan of his. You know that? That's
No,
weird.
I like his stuff.
But no, a lot of people love his stuff.
Yeah.
I just do not like he did Cosmic Odyssey, and he did a lot of stuff for DC even.
Yeah, he did some other covers for these Elseworld annual. He did that one. He also did the cover for Adventures of Superman and I think a couple other ones. But it's definitely a contrast to the John Byrne pencils in the interior. So
I don't like his art. But everybody has different tastes.
yeah. I mean, this is nowadays he pretty much, ever since he launched Hellboy, I mean, that's pretty much all he does. But back before that, he did some DC work.
I'm eating a Swedish fish right now, and it's like lime flavor And it tastes like toilet water smells when you put that like bleach that
Ooh.
bleach blue stuff in there.
Uh-huh.
Not that I've ever tasted that, but it smells like that.
Smells like a, tastes like a toilet cake, huh?
No.
So you're all out of toilet cakes, so you're eating Swedish fish instead.
That's right.
Man, Barb's gone for like an hour, and
And I'm eating toilet cakes,
you're already eating perf.
urinal cakes.
Jeez. Gets
I've
bad quick.
always wanted to try one, but Barb never let him in the house.
She keeps smacks it out of your hand before it gets in your mouth.
Yeah, it
Don't you
says do
eat
not
that.
don't eat that.
Don't eat that. Bad boy.
All right, well, you have a good one. I'll talk
All
to you
right.
soon.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.